Blog Talk Radio. Peace, peace, peace. Welcome to High Frequency Radio. I apologize for the delay. I had some technical difficulties here. I wasn't able to unmute myself. So I apologize for the long delay. As you guys know, I'm pretty much well-structured and on time. So I'm going to play a little bit more music, rather see if it plays. Let me get a chance to prepare for the show. Stand by.
I do. I'm young right now, but I won't be forever. So I'ma live it up like that's true. You might wanna roll with me too, but I don't mean to brag. But I live a life that most can only dream about, yeah. So baby, come be my dream girl. Pick up fantasy and let me work out, yeah. Tell me where you wanna go, what you wanna do. So we living it like we own it, own it, own it. To the most top of the world, what I need is you. So we living it like we own it, own it, own it, yeah.
Never too much, so just let the drink flow. Later on you can come through, through, come through. Know you're the flyest. They should call you your highness. They call me king cause I'm that dude. All you gotta do is be your crew. But I don't need a brag. But I live a life that most can only dream about, yeah. So baby, come be my dream girl. Pick up fantasy and let me work out, yeah.
We living it like we own it, own it, own it.
Listen, everything happens for a reason. Seeds born, elders die, all things in season. These days, I'm just trying to get in where I squeeze in. Scratch that, I bust the game open till it's bleeding. That's that, D-Don Kimasi, Mau Mau Posse, guerrilla warfare, no man will ever stop me. Cause I run with tall, black-skinned Anunnaki, with 4 pounds of silver-plated chrome in their pockets. But most days, I am non-violent, just don't cut my whiz and I remain silent. And when I speak, my truth weighs a ton. The scales tip as bricks of gold fall off my tongue. Your bars become stiff and cold as you succumb to the spit I hold between my molars for fun. Yeah, in all fairness, I get it from my daddy. MLK, baby, raised up on the avid. Offspring of ghetto life, crumbling brick and tragedy. They say that we have it good, I say that they imagining. I came from war day, where soldiers stayed in war state. Anger see through jagged teeth cause they couldn't get a warm plate. I made it out with a number two in the clean slate. A dirty conscience haunts me when I shouldn't even be awake. Cause I was born in the 80s just like my friends was. But now I'm getting texts about this from an overdose. And not that he was my closest friend, but I hold him close. He lived across the street in apartment B where they sold the dope. And yes, I'm going on a tangent. My mind is running rampant and writing is the only way I handle it. The booth is like my sales therapy. Ask goody. My words like food for the soul. Let go of the past with them. And past cathartic, this is life-saving for me. 14 years old, sliced and arms, but life gave up on me. But I had taken Russ and De La Soul and brand new to say that hip-hop showed me God is nothing short of purest truth. Show I do this to prove a point to my critics. Lyrics like fire bullets, they seeking targets to finish. My limits have been crossed. Now I've made it my business to personally master these rappers who pack shit with a ribbon. Presented to children who don't know how to tell the difference between a lie and authentic or being alive and just living. I'm here to tell you my vision with IMAX precision. My storyline is still building, the climax impending. But I am the protagonist, but I come out winning. The top of a long way from my start and humble beginnings. Finna get it like a champion, going after the pennant. Like mortgage pirates who siphon and red gold off of your pendant. Swinging the pendulum, trying to send it back to the middle. When it's settled, I'm telling you, I'll have mastered the rhythm, 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 rhythm.
Me without a mic is like a bee without a snare. Don't you even go there. Tearing to your ego. Freestyle with no rehearsal. Me without a mic is like a bee without a snare. Don't you even go there. Tearing to your ego. Freestyle with no rehearsal. Don't.
Baby squirrel use a sexy motherfucker.
Give me your attention, baby. I gotta tell you a little something about yourself. You're wonderful, flawless, who you a sexy lady. But you walk around here like you wanna be someone else.
Peace. Welcome to High Frequency Radio. This is your host, Brother Sharif, coming at you Tuesday, January 14th, 2014. We got an interesting show here today. But for all the listeners, this show is for you. It is not for me. I got a couple of guests that will be joining me in the second hour of the show, second half of the show, rather. And of course, as you guys know, for the Sharif Show is about mortgage and debt collection. And we're going to go into some new news that has been circulating around. We're going to talk about some other issues that's not directly related to mortgage and foreclosure and debt collection, but may have relevance. Calling number is 424-222-5250, 424-222-5250. Dial 1 if you have a question. All right. Again, the calling number is 424-222-5250. Dial 1 if you have a question. If you don't have a question, please don't dial 1. The email address for High Frequency Radio is highfrequencyblogtalk. That's highfrequencyblogtalk@gmail.com. My direct email address is thelawmaster44@yahoo.com. thelawmaster44@yahoo.com. If you're on your computers right now, go ahead and open up your email browser or your email account and go ahead and send an email to those two email addresses so you can be put on the email contact list. That way you will receive all the information regarding what Brother Sharif is doing, what the network is doing, what seminars, webinars, or events may be going on, and you also will be the recipient of a lot of information that is discussed on this network. So send an email to those email addresses. Also, if you have a question, comment, or concern that you are unable to get answered on the show, you can email those two email addresses and possibly get your question answered. All right, let's go over a couple of things. Those of you that didn't have the opportunity to experience and participate in the January 11th webinar with myself and the priest Elishua Yahweh, it was a very, 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 very enlightening event. The spirit, the universe, the ancestors was definitely in the place. We definitely went over some things, covered some important aspects of those of you that are dealing with foreclosure, debt collection issues. And then the second half, our illustrious priest, Elishua, just tore the fence down, teaching us some puritanical issues, some spiritual foundation, divine law, natural law, and things of that nature. It was definitely a great webinar. It is always, 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 always a great experience to have both issues that cover matters we may be going through commercially, and then on the second half, be able to provide you the spiritual aspect and foundation so we don't pull our hair out and go crazy and lose our mind. So, and speaking of that, I'm going to share with you an experience Brother Sharif had in court this week with a Magi magistrate. And I thank God I had an opportunity to get some of the priest Elishua's spiritual donations, because I definitely needed it dealing with this rogue magistrate. And I'll share that with you. It'll be interesting in the second half. Okay. I'm going to go over a couple of house issues before I dive into the topic of the show. Again, if you have a question, you need to call in 424-222-5250. Call in, press 1. If you have a question, comment, or concern. But I'm going to make a couple of statements regarding a few past shows that I have done. It is my understanding that some of us in the community are somewhat confused about all the different procedures and processes that are out there. It is my job and my fiduciary obligation, and those of us on this network has committed to the people to be more responsible and liable for the information that we give. And the reason that is that there are so many different ideologies and processes and procedures out there that, one, hasn't been vetted, two, hasn't been thoroughly researched, and three, hasn't been proven, okay? As my audience know, I discussed a lot of those things in the last three shows, and there was some offense taken by a few out there that had the thought that I was attacking certain individuals. So I want to make it clear. I don't attack anyone specifically unless I call you by name, and I'm good at names, okay? But what I want to do and what my responsibility is to uplift this community, uplift humanity, and to provide information that is streamlined, that is research, that is filtered, and that has some sort of enforcement to it. Do not get me wrong. I want to make this clear, okay? There are other ways of doing things. There is different ways to cook chicken. There is different ways to skin a cat. There is different ways to handle yourself in court. There is different ways to communicate and have intercourse with your debt collectors. Okay? There is different ways of communicating, and there are competing views with everybody. All right? Everybody has a belief system. We're all entitled to that. What my goal is, and Brother Sharif's show, is to put out information in parcels. What I mean by that is that you have to start at first base. Okay, you have to start at square one. And what I'm seeing is that a lot of our listeners who are not as researched, who are not as educated in certain things, are extrapolating certain aspects of a procedure and process and just trying to go execute and demonstrate that piece without having the totality of the process. Okay, and that happens when you're dealing with anybody. When you have a conversation with somebody, they're going to remember certain aspects of that conversation, and they're going to take from it what they want. And the only thing they're going to remember is what they focused on. So what I want to do is to make sure myself and these other great people that are on this network are being more careful and knowledgeable and liable for the information we put out. We can't teach you everything in a three-hour show. It will take you and your individual collective efforts to research, study, and sometimes you may have to do that through a webinar where we are specifically teaching you step one, two, three, all the way through. Now, I make it clear, if I'm going to teach you something, I may have an entire pizza pie. Okay, and there may be 16 slices to a pizza pie. But, and I'm going to tell you where you're at in your educational level about these topics. You can't take the entire pie. I'm going to have to give it to you a slice at a time. Okay, that means if I give you a slice a week, there's going to be 16 weeks of teaching that you have to apply. Okay, but at the end of the day, you're going to get the entire pie. Okay, so that's our goal, is to make sure you get all of the pieces and that you enjoy the entire pie. But those pieces have to be consistent. And this is why I hold webinars in phases. Okay, so you can get a fundamental understanding. You can get basic fundamentals. And then for those that learn quicker or that retain information better, then they will come to a point where they can get fancy with it, okay? No differently than anything else in life. You're going to develop your own handling skills, all right? Again, we all might, you know, I play ball, and I shoot differently than anybody else. I can score a basket, okay, but nobody's going to change my shot, I'm going to shoot it the way I shoot it. Long as I can score a basket, give me the ball. But if I'm shooting wrong and I'm not scoring, then, yeah, I need to be taught. All right? So it's my responsibility to make sure that we at this network, or at least myself, will get information. We will try to discuss that information. We will try to conduct some sort of research on that information prior to delivering it to the family, the community, and the audience. And I think that's something that the listeners want. I've received an abundance of emails and communications and requests, and they're good requests, not from everyone, but enough. I've received a good bit. Some people want chat groups. Some people want to develop their own groups, and I honor that. And that's something that tells me that we're learning. We want to take this to a different level. But we have to do it collectively as a family. And it's going to take everybody's hand, no matter what topic you profess your expertise in, it's going to take everybody to jump on a procedure or to jump on a remedy, put our hands on it, put our season on it, translate it, and give it back to the community in a language that everyone understands. We all speak differently. We all understand differently. We all have different levels of understanding. We have different ideologies. We have different beliefs. Okay, we have different ways that we do things. We should be able to come together as a community, as a family. I don't care what color you are, black, white, purple, green, it doesn't matter. When you look at it, we are all economic slaves. We are all being abused by the system. We are all being abused by people that, one, neither should be in that capacity, but two, is not knowledgeable about the capacity they are in, okay? And we all must come together, and it is happening across this country. Blacks, white, greens, and purple are joining hands because we're quickly learning that it has nothing to do with race. Race is a issue, but it's only an issue with ignorant people, okay? People like the media that wants to promote racism, okay? Because as the priest said, if we learned one word I'm able to take from his webinar, was individual, individe you all, is definitely a word that I believe is on every public official's desk, in every media outlet's desk. I believe that it is intentional that they play a race card, okay? Because if you can have a group of slaves over here, and 5, 10, 20, 30,000 more groups of slaves over there, you're accomplishing having groups all across this country as opposed to in a specific area. All right? So I just wanted to get that, put that out there on the table. I mean, no offense to anyone. And if anyone takes an offense, then one or two things has to happen. We need to sit down. We need to talk about it. Okay? Like men. Or like gods, or like lords, or like kings, or whatever title we go by, or if it's a guru, okay, which was mostly exist in the patriot communities, we need to come together and consolidate some of this information, reintroduce some of this information in its purest terms, research some of this information to see whether the information is outdated. Because a lot of these processes and procedures that are going around, I've heard about for years, okay? And when I hear these things be regurgitated in communications that I receive, the people that are regurgitating that information or speaking about it, they're speaking about it like it's brand new, because it is. It's brand new to them, okay? And those of us that have been around would look at some of those processes and be like, did you not get the update on that? All right. Now, let me say this. There are many processes out there. There are many ways to do many different things. There is a need to have knowledge about consumer protection laws, about real property laws, about criminal and civil rules of procedure. There is definitely a need for trust law, for you to have education on trust law, contract law, okay? And we have enough talent on this network to be able to touch many of those topics and more. And we've made a commitment to do that, okay? So that when you're coming to a network, you know that the information has a better chance to be applicable than what you hear on other networks. And trust me, I get around. And some of the things that I hear on other networks is just ridiculous, okay? And when I refer to these gurus and things of that nature, I'm referring to those that has processes that absolutely on its face makes no sense. And we may have visitors, and I may have visitors and guests on my show that may have competing views. They might see things a little bit different. Okay, I will usually say so. Well, you know, I don't subscribe to that, or I don't agree with that, but okay. Okay, I am not one that knows it all. I can talk about it all, but I'm not an expert on it all. But I can pretty much move in any direction I desire. Okay, and what I've decided to do was to move in this direction because, one, the people has been asking for it. The people appreciate it. And the topic that I chose to spend time on for now involves people losing their homes, losing their real property, losing their money, losing their cases and debt collection lawsuits and things of that nature. So I want to thank everybody for all of the emails that I've received, and every last one of them always ends with much appreciation for what we do here as a network and much appreciation for what I bring to my show by way of helping us try to gain some economic momentum. And for those of you out there that has been blessed by the information, that has been enlightening, lightened, and that has been uplifted, I promise you I'm going to keep the information coming regardless. All right? All right, so let's move into the show. I decided on a recommendation to start feeding the appetite of some of us that are dealing with foreclosure. Okay, understand, I don't deal with foreclosure prevention. That's a statutory term. Well, that's a term that's used among the legal society. I don't think anybody's going through a legal foreclosure. So you don't have a legitimate foreclosure anyway. What I deal with is debt, and debt is may consist of mortgages or any other debt, credit card debts or any other debts. Okay, I deal with debt, period. And what I teach is what debt is and what it isn't. Foreclosure just happens to be one of those areas that consumers are dealing with, one of those debt areas. All right. So I've been asked to go more into what's going on, what's the current news out there in the court system regarding foreclosure, some of the cases and decisions, and because many of us are still dealing with those issues and find ourselves pleading or fighting a foreclosure, not with a mortgagee, but a debt collector. So I want to give a little bit of appetite to those of you that likes to get into state law, mortgage-related decisions, and things of that nature, because some of you like that. I can go all day about these things because they usually cancel out each other. One judge says one thing, another judge says another thing. The ambiguity and the divisiveness and the confusion benefits the legal society and the courts and the banks. Doesn't benefit the homeowner. All right? So I'm going to go into some of those things. And again, to those of you in the chat, thank you. Again, this show is for you. It's not for me. I have 1,000 things to do. I can be doing 100 more things. I've only done this show and maintained this show, one, because Brother Youssef invited me here. And I'm glad he did, because I didn't know personally that everyone really had an appetite for this information, and that's my fault because I stay in my zone and I'm pretty busy. But since I've come out into the public in this particular fashion, the appreciation has just been plentiful and abundant. So it's you guys that's keeping me here, trying to bring you as much as I can to lighten your load. All right, so let's go into what's going on in the news circuit. There's been some cases going on, and Brother Latif from Fix Your Mortgage Mess will be joining me. As you know, he's joined me on my show a few weeks ago. He has his own show, which is Fix Your Mortgage Mess on Blog Talk. He'll be joining me later. We'll get into some of these court cases and decisions and what's happening in the court system, because regardless of what we teach here, you're going to be dealing with court, and they're going to be relying on decisions that are geared towards true creditors. Although I think most of the decisions that come out of the court don't have anything to do with creditors. They have to do with some third-party debt collectors, but we all know that, all right? First of all, there's been some class action lawsuits going on, discriminatory lending cases have been filed against Bank of America, Chase Bank, I believe, for discriminatory lending practices against African Americans. Florida, Miami, the city of Miami, let me find it here, has filed a case against Bank of America for predatory lending against minorities. All right. As you guys know, Chase Bank paid $1.7 billion for their participation in the Bernie Madoff case. You know, $1.7 billion. I believe Mr. Bernie ran $50 billion through Chase Bank, and they paid $1.7 billion. So go figure. Trying to find that Miami case here. Let's see. Fannie Mae reached a $591 million repurchase agreement with Wells Fargo. For those of you that don't know, repurchase agreement, it has to do with REMIX, secondary market securitization, where there are repurchase agreement clauses in most of these pooling and service agreements. And as you know, since the investors are screwed, you know, they've been trying to get these banks to repurchase all of those loans. Okay, so that's one of them. There's been several of those type settlements that has occurred here in the last year or two. Miami sues Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citibank over discriminatory mortgage lending. So that's the city of Miami, not the state. The city sued in federal court. Also, while I'm on that, Kamala Harris, which you know is the attorney general, I believe, out there for the state of California, has sued, I believe it's Chase Bank. And as you guys know, Chase Bank in two states, one of which is New York, had filed several hundred thousand cases or tens of thousands of cases on credit card consumers. Basically, you defaulted on your credit card, they've been suing. But Kamala Harris had learned from the New York case, and there was a big New York case out there where there was a law firm, a process serving company, and Chase Bank and some others, I believe. Let me just say this. I don't know if it's Chase Bank, but I believe it was. And don't hold me to that. I read so much. But there was a there was some shenanigans going on where the process server was serving people with lawsuits at addresses they didn't live at, and in any instances they wasn't serving them at all. They were leaving the paperwork in the backyard and throwing it on the roof and, you know, tucking it in some water pipes, who knows, all right? And there was a lot of judgments being gotten and garnishments subsequently after those judgments were obtained. And they found out it was all a fraud. So there's a class action lawsuit going on in New York. I don't know if it's – I believe it might be Chase, but I know it's a mess. So Kamala Harris out in California did the same thing and sued Chase saying that they were robo-signing lawsuits involving credit card cases. And there's some other suits going on in the bankruptcy court class actions where, you know, these major banks, national banking associations, have been accused of manipulating bankruptcy cases with fraudulent fabricated documents, hearsay testimony evidence, you know, manufactured affidavits, the same things we discussed on this show, and should be no surprise to anyone listening. So, you know, the states are getting involved. I'll reserve judgment on why they're getting involved, but I'll just say this. There's been some billion-dollar settlements, and I don't see any of that money trickling down to the consumers. Okay? So, you know, we'll just say that for what it is. I want to read to you, there was a decision that came out of the Appellate Court of California, and it's the second appellate district, Division 8. All right. As you know, California is a non-judicial state. Okay. It is a huge state. I believe almost close in size to that of New York. So it's a pretty big district out there. You have several federal court jurisdictions out there and a bunch of state court jurisdictions out there. But this was a case that came down between a homeowner. And when I talk about contract breaches and identifying who the parties are, who can do this, who can do that, who can serve you with a notice of default. And mainly, as you guys know, I try to speak in the language that you'll be facing, and breach of contract, conditions preceding. And let me tell you what I mean when I say a condition preceding. Okay, and you'll hear that a lot, and you will see that. I urge everybody to read these judges' orders and opinions, okay? You should read them. There's a lot of hidden jewels in them. I don't say you have to read the entire case. Read the results of the case and see how these judges think, how they're acting, how they are ruling. You will gain quite a bit of knowledge and quite a bit of strategy when you do read these opinions or these orders. Okay, a condition preceding, just so you'll know, so everyone will know, it refers to an event or state of affairs that is required before something else will occur. In other words, it's something that a person must do prior to taking certain actions, okay? And that's what that means. So if you have a contract and you and I agree that before I come knock on your door, I have to send three notices, that would be considered or construed as a condition precedent, a condition you must take or do, or a performance prior to you taking a certain action, all right? So I'm going to read this opinion only because the judge appears to have some good sense. He appears to rule on the law, not on argument, and he made some pretty interesting comments in his order. This particular gentleman, Dennis Ricky Holmes, and let me go ahead since I'm quoting a case. The case is Holmes versus HSBC Bank, all right, and it's in the Court of Appeals, State of California, Second Appellate District, Division 8. Case number B2-36394. All right. And just to give you the shorts of the case, this case was involving a homeowner who had a $1 million home. All right. He allegedly received the loan from Countrywide, which all of us know is no longer in business, bought out and succeeded by Bank of America. All right. And, of course, he's in California, non-judicial foreclosure sale. He gets the normal run-of-the-mill notices, boilerplate notices of default, and, you know, and his loan was securitized. I'll go ahead and say that. And they named themselves as the J.P. Morgan Alternative Loan Trust 2007-A1, for which HSBC was the trustee. Okay? And I'm bringing this case up because when I talk to you, about conditions preceding and who is what and who can do what. I'm sure all of you out there experiencing the same issues that this judge points out in his order. And he is going to tell you exactly who can do what and who can't do what, okay? And this is important because I always told you that I don't care what they try to do. If they try to collect any debt from you, the chances are high that they're going to violate you several times before they actually get to the results of what they're trying to do. And it's those violations that you must capitalize on and turn the situation around. This is why I say the rules of procedure is important for you to learn. The rules of the game is important for you to learn. And you need to understand who is what and what is what. And you need to take the time to read your contract, your mortgage, your deed, your security deed, your credit card contract. You need to read it and understand what powers lie therein. Who can do what? When can they do it? How can they do it? And if they do it wrong, how can you make them pay? I'm going to read what this judge had to say. Okay? And this is a judge that has put out a couple of opinions before, Reuben J. Okay? He's put out a couple of opinions before that's been in favor of homeowners, just as well as this decision. All right? So I'm going to start off. When the appellant Dennis Ricky Holmes borrowed $1 million from Countrywide Home Loan, he gave Countrywide a promissory note. To secure repayment of his debt to Countrywide, he also signed a deed of trust on his Los Angeles home. As of the filing of his complaint, this is the homeowner sued HSBC. Okay, so this is not a judicial foreclosure. This is something where the homeowner was the victim of a wrongful foreclosure, and he decided to go and sue the bank for wrongful foreclosure and other causes of action, all right? So as the filing of his complaint, Holmes alleged that now defunct Countrywide had not assigned or transferred his promissory note or deed of trust to. What he's saying is that those documents that the debt collector was using, which are for creditors, was not authorized, okay? Again, in non-judicial foreclosures, you can't stop any of them crooks from filing assignments and being wrongful foreclosures. The only thing you can do is sue them or ask for a restraining order and sue them or file bankruptcy, okay? So Mr. Holmes alleges that now defunct Countrywide had not assigned or transferred its promissory note or deed of trust to anyone, including the respondent HSBC Bank or J.P. Morgan Alternative Loan Trust 2007-A1, for which HSBC is the trustee. Okay. Thus, as the record stands in reviewing a demur, lender Countrywide appears to continue to own appellant's note and the security interests under which he owes payments. All right, and I want you to listen closely. And I've said this before on my show, and anytime I speak about a deed of trust, I point to this particular issue. The judge says that under the loan and deed of trust, only, okay, and he underlined only, Countrywide, who was the alleged original lender, or its successors or assignees can declare Holmes' loan in default. So the judge is telling, and them, that only the named party, okay, a party with standing and capacity can declare Mr. Holmes' loan in default. All right? That's either Countrywide or, he said, its successors or assigns. But listen, paragraph 22 of the deed of trust states acceleration remedies. It says lender shall, and he underlined lender. Lender shall give notice to borrower prior to acceleration. If the default is not cured on or before the date specified in the notice, lender, he underlined, at its option may require immediate payment in full of all sums secured and may invoke the power of sale and any other remedies. If lender, and he again underlined it, invokes the power of sale, lender shall execute or cause trustee to execute a written notice of the occurrence of an event of default of lender's election to cause the property to be sold. Trustee shall cause this notice to be recorded. Okay? So he's already pointed out, all right? He's reading the contract, which most of us need to do, he's saying that I'm reading the contract and the conditions preceding is that the lender is the only one that has the power to make any moves. He can instruct the trustee and anybody else to make moves on his behalf, okay? The lender can. So he goes on. He says that Holmes filed his first complaint. He alleged that Countrywide's failure to declare a default or invoke the power of sale meant the respondent, Recon Trust, acted without authority when it foreclosed on his home and sold it to HSBC. So what happened was J.P. Morgan at the sale did the non-judicial foreclosure for a securitized remit, okay, and they sold it to HSBC in a non-judicial sale. HSBC came after him, and he filed suit, okay? Therefore, the plaintiff alleged that the deed, trustee's deed upon sale was void, given HSBC no right, title, or interest in his property, okay? So let me get down further. He says, the common law evolves to meet new challenges from new circumstances. In a quip often attributed, perhaps incorrectly, to the renowned economist John Maynard Keynes, and y'all need to Google him, when the facts change, I change my mind. So this is a judge saying that, you know, he understands that the way things were, and in fact, he makes a quotation in here, if you Google the order, he said, these are not the same times that our grandparents got mortgages that were simple. And I'm going to read that part because it's very, very, very kind of comical, but real. Okay? So he's saying that when the facts change, he's changed his mind because he sees all this slicing and dicing. All right? So he says, there was a time not long ago when a foreclosing trustee customarily enforced collection of a homeowner's debt at the discretion of the lender or the lender's successor, whose place in the promissory note's chain of title was easily ascertained and apparent to all. Widespread securitization of mortgage in the years before the financial meltdown of 2008 and economic catastrophe triggered in part by the often unlawful repeated packaging, selling, repackaging, and reselling of mortgages in which the mortgage electronic system, MERS, played a pivotal role, mostly unseen and poorly understood by homeowners, investors, regulators, and the public, has changed much of that. MERS is a private corporation that administers the MERS system. He goes into MERS, but he said in this new era, ownership of a homeowner's promissory note and of the beneficial interest in a deed of trust may have changed hands many times to the point where reliable proof of who owns what is hard to come by. I'm sorry, let me say that again. Reliable proof of who owns what is hard to come by. The side effect of MERS system is that a transfer of an interest in a mortgage loan between two MERS members is unknown to those outside the system. As one experienced federal district court judge noted, in seeming dismay, the mortgage industry's lending practices fueled by Wall Street's creation of ever newer and arcane financial products has appended traditionally simple, clear-cut foreclosure proceedings. This is a judge telling you that he don't even have an idea of what the hell is going on, okay? The judge said the court has dealt with numerous mortgage-related cases and in the process of wading through them, it has learned that seemingly straightforward transactions, non-judicial foreclosures, are not at all routine. Indeed, all too often they are mystifying because of the utterly confusing assignments, okay, substitutions, and other transactions. Perhaps in recognition that the mortgage business is not what it once was, courts have started to permit owners to challenge the loss of their homes on the ground that the foreclosing party did not own the homeowner's promissory note or security interest and did not represent the party who did. only the true owner or beneficial holder of a deed of trust can bring to completion a nonjudicial foreclosure under California law. And he goes on to name several cases that were beneficial to homeowners. Glassy versus Bank of America, we spoke about. Herrera versus Deutsche Bank National Trust Company. Barrionuevo versus Chase Bank is another one. Saatchi versus Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems. Ohlendorf versus American Home Mortgage Servicing. Javahiri versus JP Mortgage Bank, and others. So for those of you in California that is dealing with these type cases and you like to deal with creditor, mortgagee-related information, he just named off five cases, if you get that order, that you can quote in your litigation against these national banking associations. Okay. I'm trying to find the area where he spoke about the slicing and dicing and things of that nature. But at any rate, the results was the judge ruled that since the notice of default was issued by a trustee that didn't have standing, since J.P. Morgan, through the securitization trust, did not have proper standing to issue a default, then he's saying, based on the contract, which is the first law, he's saying that the parties that conducted the nonjudicial foreclosure and issued those notices didn't have standing and wasn't authorized to do so. Therefore, the foreclosure was wrongful. That was the results. Okay? So there you have it. As I always say, read the contract first and determine who are the parties that are utilizing these instruments. Okay? And whether they are the right parties to do so. And I will tell you almost 100% of the time, or close to it, the right parties are not executing these documents where you have a cause of action to go against them for violation of, one, if you want to go for breach of contract, then you do if you have a deed of trust, breach of trust, okay? And your consumer protection laws will come in handy. All right. I also want to talk about one other state who appears to be going in the right direction, and that was the state of Montana. All right. The state of Montana has ruled that MERS is not a beneficiary. As you know, there is a split on states and courts that accept MERS. There's some judges that don't accept them. There's some states that do. You know, all depends on how the contributions are working, in my opinion. We'll determine how these states rule. I'm trying to find it here. I don't know why it's so far down. I want to get into it because it was pretty interesting. I want to say one more thing. The state of Illinois went against nationwide title clearing, and a lot of you will see some documents, or if you had a foreclosure sale or some assignments, that'll be drafted and executed by nationwide title clearing. And what the state of Illinois did was, the attorney general, I believe, went and sued them for violation of the Consumer Fraud Act and the Uniform Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And the crux of that case was Nationwide Title Clearance was doing assignments, I believe. I haven't read the entire case, but my belief is that they were doing some assignments that that alleged that they were assigning both the note and the mortgage when that wasn't the case. Because as we know, MERS does not hold notes. They are not listed on the note. They are not named on the note. And they never come into possession of the note. So they had a consent order. They sued. I believe they entered into a decree and a settlement on that basis, and they were told to stop filing those type documents. that says that you assigned a note that you never had. So, you know, the states are jumping on these lending institutions, I believe, to line their own pockets. I just wanted to share that with you. I don't know why I'm not finding the state of Montana situation. I want to find it for you because the state of Montana, the Supreme Court, okay, not the lower court, Supreme Court said you need to look out for these servicers and alleged mortgagees. That was the title. That's what they said. You need to look out for them. Okay. And they said, pay attention. But they said, for now, we're going to take MERS out of the picture. MERS is no longer a beneficiary in their state. And you will notice that a lot of the southern states really don't have a whole lot of action on these matters. States like Kentucky, states like Montana, really don't have those issues because those are states that really are consumer-friendly states. They're not going to have any national banking institution or anybody else coming and abusing their citizens because they know that if they abuse their citizens, they won't have any, okay? All right, the banks can't do anything if you're not doing business with them. So if people become reluctant to deal with banks, then you know they know that the banks will dry up. And the people will still be sitting there wondering why you allowed them to be abused. Okay? So that's about all I'm going to go into right now. That's a little bit of I think I have one more thing to go over here. You know, one other matter. For those of you that are in Florida, I believe you know David J. Stern. David J. Stern ran the foreclosure mill down there in Florida. And as you know, Florida is a judicial foreclosure state. And he was basically one of the first law firms to be doing the robo-signing and, you know, all the other crimes that entailed people having their property stolen from using the legal system. So the Supreme Court of Florida finally, after years, disbarred foreclosure king David Stern. I really don't think he gives a damn. I've been in Florida. I don't know if any of you have been down there. But if you go to Florida and you go on one of the water taxis or tours, one of those boat tours down in Fort Lauderdale, you are able to, they take you on a tour of all of the waterfront properties. And there's some heavy ones down there, to say the least. Some $30, $40, $50 million homes. Some of the big wigs have homes down there. The man that made Viagra, a couple of stars down there. You know, it's big money pocket row. All right. Well, David Stern has a house on that waterway, and it's ridiculous. I mean, I think it's about maybe a quarter of a mile big. I mean, just absolutely unreal. I heard this man made close to $1 billion. So I think he's saying, yeah, I don't need your license anymore. I got enough money to make whatever license I want. Thank you to the court system down there. And there's a lot of cases that he had that is tangled and tied up, and it's just a big, big mess. And this man didn't get anything. I think he settled with Florida. I think he paid something like $2 million was an article I read a couple of years ago. He paid like $2 million in a fine for something. And other than that, I believe he bought 50 of those Five Guy burger chains and some other stuff. But at any rate, just wanted to give you a little update on that little bit of news for you homeowners out there to have an appetite for that type of stuff. I think I mentioned before that Ocwen Bank got a $2.1 billion judgment with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, who is the new debt collecting police. And they went after Ocwen for servicing issues and failures and fraud and all kind of stuff. So, you know, a lot of money being slung around. We're not getting any of it, which is why we have this show to teach you how to get your bit. Because if you read some of these complaints that these attorney generals and that these courts go have in the courts, you will be able to take some information from you that can be included in your complaint. Not to say that what they say is true, but trust me, they're jurors. They know how to present their case. So you should read some of these cases and read some of the results of these cases and read some of these orders so that your complaint or your understanding of what these violations are clear to you. All right. So let me look in the call queue here, see if my guest is here. And I'm going to go and take a couple of questions. Got a few people in the queue, and we'll go on. I think I covered everything I wanted to. All right. And then I'll get into my what happened in my case this week, and you guys are going to laugh. All right. So let's go to the caller line. Let's go to 661-0241. 0241. You're on High Frequency Radio.
And this look.
Let's go to 1111. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question? 1111. Do you have a question? All right. Let's go to 443-1257. 443-1257. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Hi, good morning, everyone. In reference to post-sale, and you have two parties on the deed of trust, and the house has been sold, and now it's a year later, but 20 years prior, one party has left. When you file a wrongful complaint, will that second party that left have an avenue or a way to come back, even though the first party is filing by herself?
Okay, sister, I want you to slow down a little bit so I can retain all of that. So,
okay.
Is that the same party? Tell me what you have going on. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm calling for someone, actually, but on their deed of trust is a male and female. They had the house for 25 years. However, the male left 15 to 20 years ago. She's in foreclosure. As a matter of fact, they sold her house, and I wanted to know so I can pass this information on to her. She's filing a wrongful foreclosure complaint, but she's the only one filing. She's going to file it in her name alone with the information that you provide and everything in reference to the FDCPA and other issues.
Mm-hmm.
But will it be an issue when she's in court, the judge can say, well, he's not here, so we cannot hear this case because the second party on a deed of trust is not present? That's the first question.
No, in my personal opinion, both parties don't have to be there to file a case. I mean, she has her own damages, and she can plead those damages or bring a complaint before the court. So, no, that's not going to stop her, and it doesn't have to be both parties. You could have split up or broke up or whatever have you.
Right.
Now, the foreclosure is going to go against both parties that are on a deed of trust, not unless she, you know, I don't know what type of relationship they're having, but, you know, you said the foreclosure already occurred?
Yes, the
okay, so changing the deed is of no probative value right now. So changing the deed over to her name, you know, won't do. So, yeah, she can go ahead and file her, you know, wrongful foreclosure case or whatever type of case she's thinking about in her name, and that's not going to be a problem.
Okay, and second question is when you file a quiet title to a trust, which entity, the depositor, the sponsor, or the trustee, do you file the quiet title to? Or who do you
address? Okay, you said quiet title against a trust?
Quiet title for a property that's in a trust. A bank no longer owns it, it's in a trust. Which entity?
You mean a REMIC trust? Is that what you're talking about?
Correct.
Like an ABC?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah, you would look up, right, you would, well, you're going to, you know, that's a good question, but you're going to have to sue the people that's coming after you because they're saying that the ownership rests and lies in the REMIC, okay? Now, you can look up the pooling and service agreement for that REMIC, okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they're incorporated. You have to look, you have to go to the Delaware Secretary of State. Most of these REMICs are incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to look that up, look up who the registered agent is, and if you wanted to include them, yes, go ahead and sue them as well. But you're going to have to deal with the people that conducted the alleged foreclosure as well. So you have to include both parties. Okay.
Well, that's just it. The people that conducted the foreclosure was the debt collector because the original lender is no longer in business.
Right. And that all depends, but more than likely, yes. If you have a REMIC that is coming after you, more than likely, yes, they didn't have an interest and they had no standing to conduct the foreclosure. So, yes, you'll have to go after them. Okay. Now, let me tell you about Quiet Title. I always, my opinion, okay, this is my strategy. I don't initially go for Quiet Title. But if you already had a foreclosure, okay,
right,
then you might have a basis for doing so because at that point you need to challenge title. But my initial
right.
thing is to start off with the consumer protection aspect of it, okay, and then once I'm able to squash and identify who they are and put them in their respective lane as a debt collector, then once I
right.
resolve that matter in the court, Quiet Title is easier because now you already
okay.
have an order that is determined that, look, you're a debt collector. No, you can't use that. Yeah, that's a creditor-related form. That's a document that only be executed, like the judge said, you know, by the lender.
Right.
You're not the lender, so you did violate the consumer protection law. Now when you shut them up with that, now you go file a Quiet Title because they're not going to come in there with that nonsense because you'll be able to say this is
okay.
res judicata because the judge already determined you're a debt collector, so, man, just go ahead. Now you're going to file your
okay.
Quiet Title because it's going to mostly be uncontested. But if you file a Quiet Title off the rip, oh, they're going to come after you real hard because the judge is going to look at it that you really haven't done any conditions proceeding. You haven't even vetted them. You don't even know who they are. You just filed a Quiet Title. And normally, most Quiet Titles, a lot of them, that are filed that way usually don't have a favorable result. Because you have to have strategy. There is a way. And I'm not saying it's just my way, but that's the way I deal with it. Okay? I want
right.
to get the,
okay.
the I want to get the loan to the point where it's uncollectible based on several things, based on the fact that I might have an order from a judge saying that you're not a creditor. You're a debt collector.
Mm-hmm.
You're not allowed to do that. Once I accomplish that, then by that time, I'm probably already closer to the statute of limitations, meaning that they can't do anything anyway. And now I use both of those elements, then I go file a Quiet Title and just go clean them off, and it becomes easier because I know they're not coming to court because I got an order saying that you can't come
right.
in here, that you're not a creditor.
Okay.
So that would be my preferred way of handling that. But while I have
okay.
my other guest on the line, Brother Latif, do you want to add to that answer or add anything to what the sister may do or tactics she may employ to handle that situation of a wrongful foreclosure?
First of all, good evening.
Good evening, brother.
Sharif. And welcome to the audience out there on High Frequency. And I was just observing some of your fine studious comments there, and I wholeheartedly agree with you on a lot of the points that you were making, particularly on that Quiet Title, that there are some things that you want to do prerequisite to filing it. I know that Quiet Title is a buzzword that everybody says, well, file Quiet Title, but you want to show in that there is a genuine issue of fact of who the title holder is and who they are not, okay? And and also that you have either communicated with that group, challenged them about their title conflict or whatever. And in the case of what Malik is saying, if you get a judgment about that the fact that they're debt collectors and not a creditor, that's all more the merrier. Now they can't switch hats. They have nothing
right, okay.
that allow them to switch hats or musical chairs. Okay?
Right. Okay.
Now, in Quiet Title, there's a couple different remedies for it. Quiet Title, you have the state law that you're going to look at because the land record for Quiet Title is in the state. But you also,
okay.
the federal courts can also do Quiet Title. There's a code under the USC code that allows for Quiet Title, but basically they're going to leverage the state law. We're in Georgia, and Georgia has a Quiet Title to all the world. And in that particular case, what happens is that you want to get a special master appointed. Now, I understand
okay.
that special master will can be an attorney, a law firm, or someone like that, that you can have some opportunity to agree to who that special master would be. It's almost like going to bankruptcy court and they assign you a trustee, okay, which is
right.
a law firm, some other person being your trustee. In this particular
right.
case, you can make recommendations. Now, the special master is supposed to do the technical review. The technical review is what are the liens, okay, and which
okay.
ones have been discharged, which ones are active liens, i.e. that the creditor is still in business or out of business, okay,
okay.
and
okay.
what assignments purportedly are saying that they were a beneficiary from the original creditor and all these other things. Now, at that point in time, that's sort of like a judicial process to determine the veracity of these assignments and everything else relating the assignment. You understand what we were saying about assignment?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, for the audience, assignments are when your deed of trust or your security instrument has the name ABC Bank on it, or Bank of America, or Chase, or some Poobah Bank, okay? The Bank of Poobah, okay? They were the original creditor. Okay? Now, they no longer have any interest in it. They sold it. So the only way that the land records get updated is that they put in an affidavit of assignment that it got passed through in some capacity, either the deed of trust and the deed of trust or the note. Okay? And this is what Malik was referencing with respect to the case
yeah.
in Montana.
And I think and that's true, and I think Brother Latif definitely laid down some of the things, but she's in California, so she wouldn't
mm-hmm.
have that same quiet title action you're speaking about, I think, is available in Georgia. But what I will say to you, sisters, that California, as you know, passed the California Homeowner Bill of Rights. Oh, you're in Maryland? I'm sorry. Okay, great. Then you're in Maryland. All right. I don't know if that particular, and I know what you're speaking of, Latif, that particular quiet title action is available, but it seems like at this point you don't have a choice because your property's already been foreclosed on. What I do recommend that you do is before you get served with eviction papers or dispossessory papers and whatnot, that you go ahead and go on the offense and have some
right.
action filed that relates to title so that lower
right.
court
now,
will have to be
now,
stayed
now,
on
now,
any.
Let me comment about one thing. Because
sure.
this is, she brings up a very interesting case and somewhat novel. And this is what I'm saying. Two people can be on the deed of trust, okay?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Now they've got to send out notices to both parties. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Did you get a notice?
Yes. They did. One party did, one party did not.
Okay, that's my point. The party who did not get the notice now has an affirmative defense that I never got notice. That's
mm-hmm.
that's cause one for a wrongful foreclosure.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So the party who has an interest in the property who did not get notice is entitled to a wrongful foreclosure that they didn't do procedurally.
Well, see, in her case, without going into details, they have severed the relationship. So she's still in the home, but like I said, he left. So she's going
yeah,
to go
chief,
ahead
so
and
the,
fight
the,
her
yeah, the
home.
Bank wouldn't know. Yeah, the bank wouldn't know that they've split. But it is
right.
I see what Latif is saying is that both parties has to give you notice. Let me tell you an example of how that works sometimes to your benefit sometimes when both parties are not. You know, there was a case I know of a friend that was doing a foreclosure, and they called and they said, Brother Sharif, you know, this is what I'm going through. She was served. She broke up with her husband. Her husband wasn't served. She didn't file
right.
her answer timely. And the attorneys were like, no, you know, her answer should be accepted. She didn't ask for continuation, and the time to answer has expired, and they were really jumping on her about it. So what I told her strategically, which is what I'm good at, strategies, I said, okay, was your husband served? She says, no. And they were on bad terms. I said, okay, well, listen, this is what you're going to have to do. Okay, you have to go back in time to where your marital situation was good, just for your mindset. And you're going to call hubby, and you're going to say, hubby, I need you to come into this case and do a removal because he wasn't served, okay, his time was not expired.
Okay.
So he can
right.
actually come in, file his answer, file his removal, okay, and then go on with the case. So it's just all about strategies, all about how you look at things. If you don't have anything else, and being that you're in a non-judicial state, it's really not going to matter, okay? But if you were in a judicial state, it might be different. But if he didn't get notice, they would have no way of knowing that her and her husband or boyfriend or whoever broke up. So they're just going to send notice to the house because you didn't change the deed. Or anything like that. You see what I'm saying? So
right.
Go ahead and file your case in her name. Don't worry about him right now. I mean, go ahead and file your
okay.
case and do your, you know, do your consumer protection laws and violations and causes of action and go ahead and do quiet title. You know, if you need
okay.
me.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, sister. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Here's one other thing I would say about that particular case, because it's very interesting. And Brother Sharif is talking about removal. Are they opposed to bankruptcy? The party that still has a right to claim, are they opposed to it?
Hello? Sister, are you still there? Yes.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Are you opposed to bankruptcy is what Brother Latif was asking you?
No, I believe she would not be.
Okay.
Well, if she's got other debts, you can do it. You can file a bankruptcy, remove it into the bankruptcy court, then remove that whole case and an action into the bankruptcy court because you're saying that somebody's interest was foreclosed on that they have not given up their right to it.
Okay.
They weren't properly served and have that addressed in the bankruptcy court under adversary proceeding.
Okay.
Now, understand this, sister.
Okay.
You know, on the consumer protection laws now, you are allowed to get attorney fees. So you can also look into competent counsel that may take some interest in your case if you're unable to do it yourself. But when you're going into quiet title, you need to be well-versed. You need to do your research, or you need to have competent counsel or consultant that's going to lead you through either one of those avenues, be it bankruptcy or a pursuit of quiet title in the state court.
Okay.
And make sure you're in the right court and make sure your pleadings is done. So, you know, do your research before you move forward on that. But move forward before they move. And that's the important thing, that we don't get too far behind the train, because we let that foreclosure train go too long, and we'll be sitting up in eviction court trying to fight when we should have fought years ago, and the judge is looking at you like, well, how many years have you been in the house? And that's what they're doing. They're going to say, how many years you haven't made a payment? 4 years? Really, they don't want to hear anything else. They're like, you already got relief. I mean, you've been living for free for 4 years. And that's how they look at it. And you really can't too much blame them to a certain extent, which is what I'm trying to teach the people, that if you have damages and you have violations, go after them. So you can show the judge, hey, judge, I done sued these people 2 years ago. Okay? So, I mean, I already took care. And then if that's the case, you won't ever get in this court if you do it right. You understand? But when you wind up in that dispossessory court or that summary court on an eviction, at that point, you know, you're almost too late, and you waited too long. So hopefully this show and the information you were able to obtain from this show is putting people on the offensive instead of the defensive. Okay?
Okay.
Well, we're going to go on to the next question, sister. I appreciate you, and come back if you have any more. All right, Latif, glad you made it here. I started off my show going over some cases. You and I went over those cases on your show. And
yeah, I heard
talking
those
about
those are excellent cases, and also there's the case out of Rhode Island that just got ruled on very recently. That's about the challenging assignments. And that's a very, very important case, because there's a trend now. There was a trend where all these securitization audits and everything else. Some of these securitization came to a halt because the courts had figured out a way to say that, well, you're a homeowner. Well, you're third party to the contract. You don't have any rights, okay? And so all the courts, many of the courts across the nation jumped on the issue. Oh, you're a homeowner? Oh, you're arguing against securitization? You don't have any rights, okay? But recently there's been a trend setting by courts to reverse that, because they're saying that if the assignment was done void ab initio, you know, that it didn't have standing to do it in the first place, then a homeowner does have assignment, can argue against assignment as being void ab initio, and that it was a violation of the controlling law under New York pooling and servicing, that controls the pooling and servicing for those REMIC trusts. So,
correct.
Again, this came out of the First Circuit. This case is some of the attorneys up there dealing with this case have commented on it and said that they thought that this was another watershed moment, that it would have the effect of shockwaves all across the United States, because you had the several cases in California, you had the Bubble case in New York, you had the Salvador case in Texas, and now you have this case, which shows that there's a trending pattern to get away from that nonsense ruling that homeowners do not have any rights to challenge an assignment, irrespective of if it's robo-signed or what type of defect. That was sort of like the easy way out for the courts not to address the veracity of the assignment. So I want to just tell them what the case number is, and then we can move on, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. That First Circuit case is Eloisa Cosa J. Eloisa Cosa J. versus MERS. And interesting enough, this is another one of those MERS cases. MERS et al., and they were showing that purportedly MERS got involved in it, but it was, you know, some years down the line. So that was a recent ruling, 2013 ruling, in the U.S. District Court for Rhode Island. So it is a district court ruling, and many attorneys are feeling that this case is another positive case in the direction of homeowners.
Great. And I just wanted to bring up one other topic before I move on, because you know one of your favorite topics is Linda Green, which is the lady that was indicted and subsequently sentenced to, how many years did she get, Latif?
No. Linda Green is the infamous.
Not Linda Green.
Lorraine Brown.
That's right, Lorraine Brown. Now, she was from,
DocX
or Linda Processing?
Right.
She's from Linda Processing?
That's correct. She was the CEO and president of Linda Processing Service, LPS, Inc. They had a subsidiary called DocX. And they were actually hiring people to craft up these assignments, say that they were vice president, make all kind of misrepresentation, and they were eventually filed to the land records. In many cases, their robo-sign activity were turned over to foreclosure mill attorneys that assisted in the matter of filing them into the local land records. Okay?
That's right. And the reason why I brought up Linda Processing was I was just looking at an article here from, and as you know, Lorraine Brown was the CEO, you said? Now, you would think that a paper mill who does nothing but manufacture, fabricate assignments for MERS and the lending institutions and the foreclosure mills around the country, you would think that that sort of an entity would be considered illegal. But I know that after her conviction, Linda Processing was sold to a group of, some of which I believe was some attorneys who were some of the investors, and they changed their name now from Linda Processing Services to Black Knight Financial Services. So they're still... Y'all have to understand what these names mean when they go dark on your asses, okay? Black Knight Financial Services, all right? So the paper mill goes on. They probably change from white paper to black paper now, but the assignments are going to still get crunk out, all right? Why that company is still in existence, I have no earthly idea. But
well, because it's the law of averages. You know that. You know, they'll get away with the crime 1,000 times before they're caught one time. So the law of averages.
That's right.
Because how many homeowners actually check their land records?
That's true.
That's right. So this is the law of averages. And just, the whole thing is also about, you know, that LIBOR. You know,
LIBOR
was so scandalous and everything else. And the people who were handling the LIBOR actually sold it. And some Wall Street people picked it up.
Wow.
Incredible.
Incredible. Incredible. So, you know, I don't understand how a state goes after a company and deems it a paper mill manufacturing documents that are used all over the country for illegal purposes, okay, and still be in business, change their name, be bought out, change their name to Black Knight, and, you know, move a couple of desks and chairs around in the office, and they're reopened for business. All right. So, you know, we'll leave that to your imagination as to, you know, what's going on. What I'm thinking is that, you know, the Black Knight contains some Black Knights. They got some deep pockets, and they probably won't suffer the same fate as Lorraine Brown. Okay? So,
well,
you know,
think,
it all depends on who's owning the company.
I think there's a subtle message. And that subtle message is white-collar crime pays.
It always has. It always has. All right, I'm going to share with you. I'm glad you're on here, Latif. I'm going to talk about my experience when I speak about knowing the rules and knowing how to have and having strategy before we get into this case. And these are things that you and I always discuss is that before you take on any case and before you move forward in your own case, you need to do some research, some planning, and some strategic, more importantly, strategic planning, meaning that you need to vet that judge. You need to look up some of his cases, possibly sit in his courtroom for a day, see how he's ruling all cases, look up his case record, look up his bio. You know, you need to know who you're dealing with before you go to court or before you take an action. You need to research that law firm that's sending you those notices. You need to look at some of the cases they've done. You need to see whether they've been sued. You need to, you know, you need to do some careful due diligence before you go into court, and you need to be prepared because most of us, what I find, Latif, is a lot of us feel like since the facts are lined up in our favor and the law appears to be in our favor, we get this false sense of security and confidence that we're going to go into court and win just on being right alone, or just by having the law on our side. And Latif, tell them before I go into my experience that I had why that is not true. You have to have some politic on your side. You have to have some strategy, some knowledge, some information, and you have to have a clear, clear, clear path of what you want the results to be, and you have to guide your case toward that end. Explain to us how the facts and the law alone just will not get you the remedy you're seeking.
Yeah, you raise a very, very good point here. And let me say this. Law has fundamentally, especially when you're in a case, two major aspects. One is actually the law. There's another one. Three is the evidence. And one is the actual law. Is there a law that covers the type of actionable cause that you're seeking? Two, what evidence do you have? Three, what procedure do you have for it to be heard? Now, complaint writing is the first procedure for it to be heard. But along the way, there's so many procedures that can knock out or limit the evidence of what you have alleged from even getting to the jury. So what we're saying is that, yeah, you have a right to a jury trial. That sounds good in the Constitution in the states and the United States. But how many of these cases actually get to trial?
That's right.
Very few. Okay? Because there's a whole procedural aspect that's going to knock it out. And so one thing is you have to be procedurally strong, which means
there you
civil rules of procedure. Okay?
There you go.
But even behind the procedural rule comes the politics. The judges may not want it in. Okay? Or, like you cited the other night, there can be sidebar conversations and say, Judge, you know, help me out here with this one. I need to get this case disposed. What should we do? Okay?
You know what? You brought that up. I need to go into that after my story. That is funny. I'm glad you brought that up. I'm glad you regurgitated that, but go ahead.
But, you know, this is the politics. And see, if you're in there pro se, you have to understand. I was having this conversation last night. Okay? It's very few chances that a pro se is going to have a sidebar conversation with a judge.
That's right.
Attorneys get that all the time.
All the time.
Okay? So they can just kind of talk off record and say, well, Judge, you know, here's what we're going with this, you know. And so it's sort of like a, feel you, you know, let me make you feel good, Judge. I'm not trying to waste your time here, da-da-da-da-da. But, you know, I know your caseload is very heavy and all like this. We can move this along. And you know what? Yeah, Judge, we can spend a whole lot of time doing discovery and all like that. But you know what? We need to move this along. Okay? And so that's sort of a nudging, a hint, and all like that. And if the judges and the courts are not committed to justice as we think it should be, you're not going to get it.
That's right. Let me go into what you're talking about, Latif. Let me go into, since you brought up that topic of ex parte communications and the obvious, you know, bias that a pro se litigant may experience in the court. There was a case out of the Commonwealth of Kentucky, all right, Henry Circuit Court, all right, and the case is Deutsche Bank National Trust Company as trustee for the certificate holders of Soundview Loan Trust 2005, Opt 4 Asset Backed Securities, Series 2005, Opt 4. Believe it or not, that is a REMIC. That is an entity, okay, with all those names. I read an opinion from a judge a long time ago before I get into that judge, and there was a lawyer that went in, and, you know, the plaintiff was one of these REMIC with about 4 or 5 sentence names, and the judge says, who is this? That says it's a certificate. A certificate is not a person. Her certificate can't sue. And he threw the case out. I mean, it was plain as day. That's right. And I said, I don't know why every judge hasn't come to that conclusion. He said, what is that? Is that a LLC? Is it an Inc.? Is it a truck? What is that? I mean, what is that? He says it sounds like a certificate. No, that's what he said, Latif. He said a certificate is a piece of paper, and a piece of paper is not a person. Therefore, it can't be a real party in interest. And he killed the case. And I haven't heard anything else from that judge since, because, you know, they probably don't want to put any more orders on blast. But at any rate, this case was involving an attorney who was doing a foreclosure against a homeowner, okay? And this is in Kentucky, and coincidentally, I mentioned Kentucky that they don't have these issues with these banks abusing their citizens because they kill all of that, all right? And Kentucky has some of the strongest consumer protection laws in the freaking country, let me tell you. All right. So anyway, this attorney, you know, had some relationship with the judge, as it appears, and you know she was there on one case, but she started speaking to the judge on another case, and she was asking for some guidance and some help. And I want to read to you some of the excerpts that was saying. This information came out because, as you know, they were in a court of record, and that microphone was still on while they were talking, and they didn't know that. And you see a lot of that in the major news outlets. You know, sometimes people get caught saying things. I think our president was caught saying some things, some other politicians saying some things when they thought they were off the air or off record, and the mic was still going. So it was one of these cases, okay? So, you know, the attorney started, hey, Judge, you know, she started asking him things. I want to talk to you about this other case. And she said, can you look it up on the docket? And the counsel, which is the female attorney, said to the judge, she says, I want you to look at a case. And she said, there's nothing on the Oldham County docket, but can you put your Henry County hat on? Obviously, this judge may have had a dual role in two counties as a magistrate or some sort of a judge in two counties, which I believe is not possible, okay? But, you know, if we don't know the laws, we don't know that they can't do that. But anyway, she was serving two roles as a judge. And the attorney was asking her, there's nothing on that other docket. Can you pull up this Henry County and put on your Henry County hat? All right, this judge is in Oldham County. So it was about a case she was having a problem with. The attorney was kind of getting a little beat up by the attorneys. And this is what she said. So she says, this is the infamous Augustine case. And the judge said, and this attorney was here on another case and showed up, actually. What's going on in that case? This is what the judge is saying to the attorney. And the attorney says, well, what happened on this case is apparently we decided, and, you know, it's kind of gargled, all right, I just don't think they put all of it in this order because this is a motion to recuse the judge. And the attorney says, well, we have determined that, this is what the attorney said to the judge, but they have determined that we are not the real party in interest and have remanded it back. So I guess your question is, what do we need to do to get it dismissed? So obviously the homeowner took some offensive action, and she was trying to get the case dismissed and asking this judge to do it. Okay, and the attorney says, "Do I need to copy you on something?" And she starts laughing. And the judge asks her, "Who is the real party of interest?" And the attorney whispered, "I don't know. I don't know if we're going to refi or what we're doing." What she's saying is that they were trying to talk the homeowner to do a refi, a modification, you know, the normal things that they try to get you guys to do that I speak against. Right, so the judge said, but there must be some issue about when they were assigned the note. And I think I think maybe the issue was that they took it within about 3 days after they filed their lawsuit. So the judge is talking about the assignment that it was outdated or they didn't have standing when they filed that case. And she said the assignment was a Lerner Sampson. And I don't know if you guys know Lerner Sampson, but that's a foreclosure mill, something like David Stern in Ohio, who has been sued and filed liable by a few courts and a few class action events, I believe, and I'm not entirely sure. I do know they've been held liable on at least one or two class action lawsuits. And they were doing the robo-signing and the manufacturing of assignments that was used all over the world. And obviously, one of these assignments wound up in Kentucky. So the judge said, you know, Lerner Sampson cited a lot of Ohio and federal law on it. This is the judge saying this, all right? They're in Kentucky. And the judge saying, yeah, they filed a lot of Ohio law and federal law on it, all right? So that tells you, you know, her competency, shows you her competency. But, and the judge says, and so I ruled in their favor, okay, based on Ohio law, and they're in Kentucky, all right? Mm-hmm. So, and the attorney says, and they have remanded it back to you, and we just want to get it dismissed. What do we need to do, says the attorney. And the judge said, I'm going to suggest that you tell them to go ahead and file. And she said, and the attorney said, file motion. And the judge said, yeah, file motion to dismiss based upon the court of appeals decision. And they set it up for one of the motion hours, just leading her, just helping this attorney basically try to dispose of a case. And she admits, okay, and they got evidence, all right? They got the recordings. She admits that we don't own it. We don't know who the hell owned it. So I just thought it'd be laughable for the audience to be able to hear the type of things that goes on in these particular courts and the type of outright just crookedness, I'll put it mildly, corruptness that goes on with some people in this society. I want to go on to Brother Latif share with the listening audience. I did a webinar on Sunday, and it was a great webinar. And what we went into was we talked about things, how people can conduct themselves in, you know, consumer protection cases and things of that nature, some of the things you can say when you are when you have a hearing, and some of the things you can say in court while you're in there, some of the challenges and things of that nature. We just went over, in my opinion, how you should move. And then we had the second half, which are Priest Alicia, who you had an opportunity to be on the show with the last time you was on here. He went into some of the natural and divine law principles, and, I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I learned so much. I was on such a spiritual high, you know, because, as you know, we're sort of navigators in this arena, and we try to bring information to the public. We absorb a lot of information. We absorb a lot of the people's situations and try to lead them in the right direction, and we wish we were octopuses so we were able to help everybody. But at any rate, the spiritual element of that webinar just had me on a high that led into a couple of days after the webinar, which was Saturday. And the priest went into how we maintain our spiritual balance, how we maintain our composure, how we maintain and subdue our ignorant passions or our anger passions, okay, so to speak. And I'll be darned if the universe didn't put me in that position, because I went to court for a friend of mine in an eviction case, okay? And I spoke about it, I believe, last week. And it was an eviction case where, you know, I went in as on the power of attorney, okay? And, you know, the lawyer tried to, you know, object to the use of me representing that person with the power of attorney, and I sufficiently quoted law that supported that position. And I told the magistrate that I am no different than him. He has no more standing, no more authority than me. I have a power of attorney. He has a power of attorney. There is no difference. So once I gave the judge the rules, okay, and let her know that I knew the rules, she got off of that. And she says, "Oh, look, I'm allow him to, you know, represent her in this matter."
Was that state or
this was a this was a well, it's a magistrate court, so it's going to be a state court.
Okay. Good.
So basically, a small claims court. All right. So, and like I tell them that, you know, sometimes those are allowed in small claims court. The rules are not necessarily relaxed, but it's a common law jurisdiction, and they allow you to do some things that a superior court or a district court may not allow you to do, and more than likely you won't be able to do so in those higher courts. But in the lower courts, sometimes they will allow it, and I believe you've had instances where you were able to help someone or represent someone through a power of attorney, a family member or something of that nature. And you've had the similar experience where it was allowed in some cases and not allowed in other cases.
Well, listen, okay. I want you to continue your story, but I just want to let you know we recently got a ruling just the other day from a federal judge allowing for a family member to participate as the power attorney and file on behalf of an elderly and ill person. So we do have a standing order where...
Great.
The courts can't allow it, okay? Even in a federal court. Okay,
beautiful.
Go ahead with the story, please.
Yeah. So, at any rate, you know, good friend and relative of mine, you know, asked me to go in there and deal with the eviction matter. And as you know, these small claim courts and summary courts, you know, dispossessory courts or magistrate courts. All right. And I had looked up, as I always do, I looked up the judge, and I mean not the judge, the magistrate, and her caseload, how she rules, her background, her bio. I looked up the attorney who was appearing for the plaintiff, kind of knew what he was about, okay? And I went in there a week prior to resolve the issue of me standing for that person. And one of the issues when we came before is when I appeared there, the attorney went through and I went through. And the clerk attempted to swear me in. And she said, let me swear you in. I said, you don't need to swear me in. I said, I'm here as an attorney, in fact. I'm not a witness. So there's no need to swear me in, and you didn't swear the attorney in. So she just sort of looked at me, and she was stunned. And I said, ma'am, you can swear me in if you swear him in, okay? Which is one of the things I tell people. They never swear anybody else in. They swear everybody else in and don't swear any attorney. So the attorney has no obligation to tell the truth, okay? He can lie through his teeth because he's not under any oath. So I said, and so the judge looked at me, she says, why you don't want to be? So I said, well, ma'am, I'm here as an attorney. You know, in fact, I'm not going to be sworn in unless he's sworn in. I'm not going to be providing any testimony here today. And she says, okay, yeah, I understand. So, you know, again, knowing the rules. So we went forward, and I knew, first of all, that based on an observation of her caseload, that she had a 89% judgment rate for landlords, which are many times banks. I knew that she had a 92% judgment rate in favor of creditors. So what I knew I was dealing with was a very bank plaintiff-friendly magistrate. Okay, I knew that going in. So strategically, I'm going to figure out, one, which is what I do, how I can get her steered into the lane I want her to be in. I also know she had a problem or an issue because of the structure, because of my articulation, because of my pleadings, because of the format of my pleadings. As one knows that in magistrate court, the environment is very relaxed. Because it's a common law court where people are going to be arguing about dogs and chickens and who took my cookies and, you know, my husband is, you know, just things that really doesn't entail you having an abundance of legal knowledge, all right? And another thing I want to explain to folks when I go into how I talk to this particular magi was the fact that you need to know who you're talking to, what power they have or don't have, and what the rules are. And I teach you have to know the local and you have to know the district court rules and your state rules. You have to know them. You don't have to argue with a judge. You don't have to be argumentative at all. You just got to know the rules. And if you know the rules, you're able to keep them in their lane. So anyway, we went through, after we got through the sworn in process and we got through that, we went and we took our seats. And I know she was looking and, you know, she wanted to come against me because the attorney, you know, as they do live TV, they walked in, he was up there talking to the judge and, you know, doing his societal ritual, you know, letting the judge, yeah, I'm here, judge, you know, give me some help. I'm going up against a real guy here, judge. I need some help, you know, bar society, the society, help me out. I don't want to be embarrassed. Now, when I walked in, there was a pretty substantive amount of heavily melanated people there, our people there, okay? And, you know, when I go to court, Latif, I'm suited up. I mean, I look the part. I talk the part. I walk the part. All right. So I had a little audience, and I wanted to demonstrate a little bit. And I already knew what the result of the case was going to be. I needed to get that case out of her court, and I had a strategy in mind to do so. So when I walked in, this is what she says, and you're going to crack up. So we start off the case again. I'm the defendant, and the plaintiff comes in on an eviction, and I got my paperwork laid out. And, you know, she begins talking, and she opens up, and, you know, the plaintiff starts going over his case, and he starts saying, judge this, judge that, and I said, well, judge objection, you know, I'm objecting because, you know, he doesn't have a witness there, and I said, judge, that's hearsay, he doesn't have any evidence before the court, and I said, I understand that I'm in a magistrate court, okay, but I'm sure the rules are not relaxed. Okay, and the rules of evidence is not relaxed because I'm in a magistrate court. I understand that the formality of paperwork may be a little bit relaxed. I said, but judge, you know, the plaintiff still, regardless, plaintiff has the burden of proof. So when I said that, that's all I said. I mean, that's all I said. The magistrate turned around, okay, and she said, Mr. Sharif, you can just talk to me straight. You don't have to sound like an attorney. You are laughing, and I want the audience to laugh. I'm serious. That's what she said to me. I said that one sentence. She said, you can talk to me. You can just talk to me straight. You don't have to talk to me and sound like an attorney. And I said, well, I had to shake. I had to say, what? I said, Magistrate, I'm very sorry if my articulation or my vernacular offends you. This is how I talk, actually. And I'm in a legal setting, so this is the way I talk. If that offends you, then I'm sorry, I can't reduce myself to something that I am not. And I said it real calm and cool, because at that point I already knew I was already Dennis Rodman in her. I was in her head because I done challenged the swearing. She done had to let me stand it through a power of attorney. She's seeing the paperwork. She's seeing that I know the rules of the game, okay? And I already know, based on her judgment percentage, that she's going to rule against me. So I want her to be so focused on me as an individual and attack me in some way that she beats the rules. That was my strategy going in, okay? And the only thing I used was my intelligence, my knowledge of the rules, to keep her in her lane. So after she went on about, you know, everybody looked around. There was a couple of sheriff deputies in there, a couple of them I knew. And the audience looked when she said that. She said, you don't have to talk to me all, you know, like that, sounding like an attorney. So I said, and Judge, I'm just curious, how does an attorney sound? I'm wondering if you're going to tell the attorney not to sound like an attorney. She says, no, Mr. Reeve, I'm just saying it. You can just talk plain to me. I said, well, Judge, I don't know what that means unless you define what plain is, but I'll have to continue talking the way I do, and I'm sorry if that offends you. So that was the first round. So we went around, and, you know, the plaintiff was talking, and he said, Judge, you know, I object to this, and I object to that, and, you know, and he says, you know, they haven't, you know, the person hasn't paid rent, and, you know, this and this and this and that, and, you know, he's going on, and I said, objection, Judge, objection, magistrate. I kept referring to her as magistrate. I said, objection, magistrate, that is hearsay, and if he doesn't have a competent fact witness here, any evidence before the court, I don't have anything before me but a complaint, and I'll go into why that complaint lacks any merit and why the court possibly may not have jurisdiction in this matter. And she's just looking at me, rolling her eyes, as I'm talking about jurisdiction, and I'm just like, Judge, I'm sorry, I just have to do things the way the rules demonstrate. And so she went on, and she says, and I says, Judge, rent was paid to the owner. And she says, well, do you have any evidence of that? I said, Judge, I'm under no illusion that I don't have to really provide anything here today. I'm a defendant. The plaintiff must prove his case. Okay? He has the burden of proof, and I can choose to sit here and not say anything. I said, so you asking me for evidence is something that the plaintiff has the obligation and responsibility to do. I said, now, but to help you out, yes, I do have evidence of that, okay? So she went and she said, well, show it to me. So she went and she took the evidence that I had, and in this case, it was a situation where there were some repairs done to their rental property, and I'll speed this up, some repairs done to the rental property, and there were some receipts that was provided to the landlord by this person because the landlord failed to make some repairs. So I was able to submit that to her, and she said it was too dark. She couldn't see it. So she says, well, I can't see this, so I can't allow it. So she says, are you sure, you know, these repairs were made? And this is what she's asking me now. I'm showing her the receipts. And so I said, well, Magistrate, do you doubt that the repairs were made? And she says, yeah. She says, well, I'm going to call over there. She told the clerk to call over to the repair company. This is how, Latif, I'm dead serious. This is how she was. So I already knew I had her in my web because she was trying to do everything in the world to discredit me. And I was just as poised and just as smiling. And, you know, the sheriff deputy was smiling and the clerk was looking over. I said, yeah, Judge, why don't you go ahead and do that? You want to take a recess? She said, no, wait right here. Have the clerk go on and call and have him fax you over a legible copy of these. Anyway, she said, now, if you're lying to me, you better tell me now. This is what she says. I said, oh. I said, well, Judge, I said, well, Judge, I wouldn't lie under oath, neither would I lie, me not being an oath. Putting back in her face that I could lie because I'm not under oath. I'm going to be just as strategically deceptive as this attorney is, okay? So she went and she called and she got back and she didn't say anything, okay, because I already knew that the information was verified. I said, magistrate, I said, you know, I seen the clerk came back. Were you able to obtain the evidence of that? She says, yeah, I have it. And I said, well, is it exactly what I said? And I said it pretty loud. Is it exactly what I said? And she says, well, yeah, I'm looking at it. It appears to be. I said, well, is it, Judge? Because is it magistrate? Because if it's not, I'll take a recess and get you more information. I was rubbing it, okay? I'm rubbing a lotion in her face. So we went on, and she got that information, and she went on to say that, and she says, well, I said, magistrate, is there any evidence that the plaintiff has or any witnesses he's going to be calling today or anything like that? And she says, well, no. I said, well, then I move to dismiss the case. And she says, on what grounds? I said, well, you have my motions, and I need you to rule on those motions before we proceed. And she says, well, this is a trial. I said, okay, well, it doesn't matter what it is, Judge. Are dispositive motions not applicable to trial? Can I not move for dismissal if the plaintiff is here? Does it have any evidence? Does it have any witnesses? I mean, what are we accomplishing today? She says this, Latif. She says, why do you keep referring to me as magistrate? She says, I'm Judge Dudley. And that's when I said, oh, I said, I'm sorry, magistrate. I mean, I'm sorry, Ms. Dudley. I said, I thought you were a magistrate. She says, I'm a judge and magistrate there. I said, well, I'm sorry again, because I'm of the belief that there's a difference in a magistrate and a judge. And she says, oh, you are? I said, yeah, absolutely, ma'am, I am. And she said, well, what may that difference be? I said, well, it's my understanding that a magistrate only has to have a high school education, okay, and live in a particular area for 2 years. Now, I may be wrong, but that's my understanding. And if I'm wrong, please correct me, because I don't want to address you inappropriately. I said, now, are you a magistrate or a judge? Because trust me, I don't want to offend you. I wouldn't want anybody to call me out of my name. She says, I am a magistrate. I said, well, is it not true that a magistrate only has to have limited education, a high school diploma, and a judge is usually has a law degree and is licensed by some bar society? I said, so that's a clear difference, is it not? And you should have seen her face when I said that. And you should have heard the grunt. You should have heard
what color did it turn?
It turned purple. Purple. And the people in the galley, my people was like, woo! It was like, oh, I didn't know that. Okay. So when I said that, you should have seen the attorney look and be like, no, he didn't. Magistrate, if I'm wrong, let me know. But I try to call magistrates magistrate and judges judges. You know, I'm just good with titles. That's all. I'm just good at addressing people correctly. Oh, she didn't like that. So she went on and she says, well, what about this other case? We filed a separate lawsuit against this particular entity, right? We filed, you know me, I'm strategic. We filed a separate lawsuit in the higher court. And she says, well, what about this case? I said, well, Judge, you know, I really don't have a right to discuss that case with you, because you don't have any jurisdiction over that case. That's an entirely different court. And I think it would harm my cause if I was to discuss that case. She said, well, I have the case here. I'm like, well, I understand why you have it. She said, well, would you be opposed to having that case removed to me, to this court? I said, oh, respectfully, Judge, magistrate, absolutely not. And she says, well, why not? I said, I don't want to answer that question. And she says, well, no, you can go ahead, Mr. Stringer, why don't you go ahead and answer that question and tell me why? I said, well, magistrate, you know, I believe that these lower courts, these magistrate courts, are, you know, courts that deal with certain matters that are of a lower importance than that which my case revolves around. I said, you know, magistrate courts deal with, you know, common law issues, you know, marital issues, property issues, people fighting over, you know, and I use the word chickens and pets and things of that nature. So I think this case has a greater importance, and I think it should be adjudicated by a judge. Okay. Ooh. When I said that, she took offense to it. So she says, well, okay, so you didn't want to have the case so we can hear both? I said, no, absolutely not. And she said, so I guess you don't trust a magistrate court is what you're saying, Mr. Sharif. I said, no, Judge, I just think, you know, I would have a better success at having a jurist adjudicate the matters in this case, because I'm aware of the fact that, you know, 85% of the landlord cases in this court orders are in favor of the landlord. So, I mean, it's some pretty good landlords here. And I understand that 92% of your debt collection cases result in a favorable judgment against the consumer. So, and she says, and where did you get that from? I said, your caseload. And, you know, and she says, oh, okay, so you've done your research. I said, yes, magistrate, that is my job. So she went on, and we went back and forth with a couple of other comments. So as you know, I already knew what the ruling was going to be, and you know that I go in with my appeal already written out, signed, and ready to file, because my strategy was that I knew that on appeal, the case was going to start all over, and it was going to be in a higher court where I'm going to have a judge, and where this plaintiff was going to have to produce evidence and competent fact witnesses, things of that nature. So essentially, the case was going to start all over. So I wanted to make sure that she didn't dismiss the case, because part of my claim in the lawsuit was wrongful eviction. And if he hadn't obtained an order for wrongful eviction, I wouldn't have been able to obtain the damages for that. So I knew she was already going to rule against me, and I wanted her to rule against me, but I also wanted to demonstrate to her that you have to respect people that come in here that know the rules and not try to be biased against them. So I wanted her to get off of her square and focus on me and not the facts, which she did, violate several rules, which she did, okay? And that was my whole strategy. So the results of when she went down the line, she says, okay, well, Mr. Free, I'm going to have to rule in favor of the plaintiff. And I said, oh, Judge, I absolutely understand that, and I said, you know, I kind of figured that. And she says, well, you know, you just haven't proven your case. And I said, again, magistrate, I disagree with you. I have no obligation. I can choose to sit here and not say anything. I'm a defendant, and the plaintiff hasn't provided one nick of evidence. She says, well, you got to understand that he doesn't have to do that in this state. And I said, really? Well, Judge, I'm not going to argue with you, but I have several case law here that I can discuss. I said, but she says, well, do you want to go into those? I said, no, because I don't know if this court really gets into a lot of case law, because the rules are so relaxed here that I don't think case law makes a difference. So I would rather save those issues for argument once the appellate court has the case. And she says, so you appeal? And I said, actually, he doesn't have the appeal right here, for you have the deputy step up and give you that. And she says, what is that? I said, that's my appeal. She said, you already had an appeal filled out? I said, Judge, I pretty much had come to the conclusion that you were going to rule in the plaintiff's favor. And that really ticked her off. And the people in the galley were like, damn. I mean, he's setting fire to her. So I got up, you know, everything went the way I thought it would go. I was prepared. The attorney followed me out, and he said, and this is just what he said. He said, I hate losing to a guy that has a suit better than me, but also talk a little bit better than me. He said, you got a set of nuts. Right? And I said, well, you know, counsel, I got to do my job. He said, I guess we'll be facing each other again soon. I said, yeah, but the terms will be better. He said, how about you and I talk tomorrow and see if we can settle this, okay? Because he said, I'm sure they don't want to spend a lot of money dealing with you in any subsequent litigation. I said, well, you know, that was my strategy, so give me a call tomorrow. So I wanted to share that experience with you, because it was funny, and I wanted the people to understand who they're dealing with, what strategies you must employ. You must always, always have a plan just in case things don't go the way you want them to go, and you must always have a strategy to make sure you're able to steer your case or your situation down the road. And when you know that you're dealing with some opposition and you're dealing with some people that don't abide by their own rules, I heard a guy, there was a guy on a call yesterday, a very interesting call, JT Bay, and he was talking about the IRS. Very, very knowledgeable guy, very informative guy. Great show that was on yesterday on USEP's show. And one thing he said, which is absolutely true and holds true in this particular situation, and he was discussing the IRS and how they don't even know their own rules and their own code, and they don't. And that's what I tell people all the time. They're going to violate several laws anytime they try to arrest you, anytime they try to sue you, anytime they try to collect the debt. They're going to violate several procedural and constitutional laws, okay? So I tell everybody that. So when I was looking at that particular case, I said that, one, why is it that we have to go in there and argue different things instead of sticking with the rules? We have to learn the rules, because I wasn't argumentative with this particular magistrate. I let her know I knew who I was. I knew who she was. I let her know what authority she has. I laid low. I knew that nothing she can do would hurt me, okay? And I steadfast on that. I don't have to get belligerent. I was pretty comical at times, and that really killed her, because it was nothing she can say. Okay, I wasn't disrespectful. I was professional at all times. And she had an issue with my articulation. She actually wanted to dumb me down. In other words, Latif, I guess she wanted me to act like a nigger. Okay, and speak like a nigger. Okay, and be ignorant, because that's mostly what she deals with all day. And she really does. So when I start talking intelligently, she couldn't handle an intelligent speaking pro se litigant and attorney on the other side. Why? She has a high school education, and y'all should know that. Magistrates don't have to have any formal education. You need to look that up, and you need to understand why you need to know the rules more than them. But my point was, the gentleman, J.T. Bay, on the show yesterday said that their books that they have, the Internal Revenue Manual and Code or any other book of an official, is usually on the desk. They're brand new. Because they don't read them. They don't have to. They tell you what they want. They say what they want. And you don't know any different, so you go for it. And this is holds true in this case. Magistrates don't have any formal education. They don't have a law degree many times. And they look in a book. And the book says, okay, you shot the lady in the foot. The book says, I got to give you a $5,000 bond. Okay, you're going to get a $5,000 bond. I mean, that's what they do. All right, so I knew before a magistrate my articulation and my intelligence was way too much for her. I didn't have to engage her. I just had to say a few things to get her off her rocker, because she's off her rocker all day. She doesn't deal with law. She doesn't deal with procedure. And I told her, ma'am, the rules are not relaxed because we're in magistrate court. The civil rules still apply. The rules of evidence still apply. All right, so stop telling me the plaintiff doesn't have to prove his case, and you're trying to get me to prove my case. But it was very interesting. It was funny. I thought I might share it with the people to always be respectful. Had I not listened to the webinar Saturday, okay, giving me some spiritual foundation, and I wasn't still in that high, I might have gotten angry, okay, and quite annoyed and elevated that situation to the point where I might have become just a little bit belligerent, not much. But always keep the emotions in your pocket, deal with the rules, and you may be successful in that. What say you about that, Latif?
Well, first of all, I want to compliment you. I think that your preparedness was A-plus, beyond the expectation. And what I mean preparedness is that you gave much thought, much energy, thought into the expectation of what would happen and what are my pre-court strategy before you go in, okay? And that's no more than what someone would do if they're preparing for a professional football game to go against their opponent or whatever. We have tried to engage people in mock trials to get them in that type of mindset. So I want to really, really commend you for giving a well-thought-out pre-trial strategy, including the research work, before you go in that hostile environment. So I can't applaud you enough and say enough about that. And the end result, you were blessed, because now the opposing attorney said, you know what, I don't want to go to battle with this guy in another court. So let's go ahead and settle this, okay? So even though the judge didn't do what she was supposed to have done, the end result is that you got the victory that you needed, okay? And that's the spiritual side of it. I also think that when you're seeing the, you know, the spiritual enlightenment and looking at things spiritually, yes, I would have said in the past, Malik would have went off. I mean, Brother Sharif would have went off. Yeah. John would have went off, or I would have went off. I remember having a conversation. I remember having that conversation with my daughter one time. I said, you know what? These judges get me so riled up. I've got to learn how to control my temper and just go with the flow. Okay?
That's
but
right.
It is that pre-trial preparation that does that for you, okay? The other thing is that the procedure aspect, we go back to this. We said that most of law, we see law is evidence, the law, procedure, you know. And if you get those three things down, you're pretty much going to be very, very on top of things. Okay? So what happened
was,
in your particular case, as I'm listening to it, is that you beat them on procedure. You know, you demonstrate to the judge, you knew the procedure, just challenge you, I'm gonna call on this and everything else. And when the judge had egg all over her face, you challenged the judge, well, what did you find, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But the judge had a prejudiced heart, okay? And the judge, because the audience was laughing at it and everything else, just her ego took over, okay? You were in the house of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh was just not going to rule right because Pharaoh has to put on the robe of authority, okay? The false robe of authority, and not the robe of justice. Having said that, because you understood the outcome, you were relaxed. I presuppose that you were relaxed. You knew what the end result. The fact that you had a notice of appeal ready to go demonstrated to her that, you know, now, there was one thing you could possibly have done.
Okay.
I didn't hear, you said that you did, which is had a recorder in there, had a sonographer in there to record the session.
Right. Well, let me speak on that, and that's something that the audience need to know. Let me speak on that. I'm sorry to interrupt you. What we have to understand is when we're going in these magistrate courts, we have to know what type of court we are in. And let me tell you why that is important. I knew I was in a court of no record. Okay, there was nothing that I said in that courtroom or nothing that the plaintiff said in that courtroom was recorded, meaning that on appeal, you got to start all over again. There is not even a record there, okay? So I already knew you have to understand the four corners of litigation to understand what you're up against. That's why I don't get all twisted. And let me just say this, and I don't brag at all, but I always try to uplift people by my presence, whether it's a conversation, whether it's greeting someone. I always try to leave them with a word of wisdom, a word of uplifting. When I left that court, and I'm telling you, it was amazing. Like I said, it was all melanated people in there. There might have been one or two other ethnicities in there, but it was all melanated people in there. And they were people sort of like the people that are on our show that are fighting, that are looking worried, that were scared, okay? I seen nothing but fear in this magistrate court. All right? Let me tell you what those people, when I left out of that courtroom, there's probably about 30 people in there. When I left out, when I finished, the deputies, whom I know, shook my hand, winked at me. One of the other court people in there that I know kind of winked at me. And I walked out, and there was at least 12 people that came out behind me. Can I get your business card? Can I get your number, please? Oh, my gosh, you just really – I said, listen, I'm not an attorney, okay? I'm just a person just like you guys. I read the rules. Okay, I did my research, and that's all you got to do. If you found anything that I said in there that will help you in your case today, feel free to plagiarize it, okay? Mm-hmm. I just want you to understand who you're dealing with, what you're dealing with, what authority they have, and what authority they don't have. You can't say it like I say it. You don't need to do it like I do it. But, you know, I gave a few. There was a lady there that was interesting. She was part of some sort of like an NAACP, and she was helping a string of homeowners in there, and she happened to be in there while I was in there, and she said, please, please, Mr. Sharif, bless me with your number because you can help so many people. I said, and, you know, a couple of them might be on the show here today, and I'm going to open up the lines to see if they were there, and maybe they can tell you how that situation went down, because I told all of them, just come to my show on Tuesday, come to High Frequency Network, you know, listen to all of the hosts on this show talk about a variety of issues, but if you want to hear me more, just go back and listen to some of my calls, start from the first one and work your way up. Okay, and I said, you know, that's what you need to do first. But I did give my number to the lady that is out there trying to help homeowners that are being evicted from wrongful foreclosures, and she was really doing a good, honorable thing. And I did give out my number to a couple of people, but I just told them, listen, y'all heard what I said, and you take the same road, and you'll have the same results. It's all about strategy. It's all about not being scared. It's all about you not looking up that bench, but looking straight at that judge, looking her in the face and understand what she can do or he and what they can't do. Okay, this judge forced me to be sort of narcissistic and sarcastic with her because I already knew she had a bias. One, it might have been color. It might have been knowledge. It might have been intimidation. It might have been a conglomerate of both. But she, I'm sure she went home, have some nightmares, maybe calling me some names. And the plaintiff attorney probably did as well. But you and I know, Latif, the attorneys don't take anything to heart. They don't take anything serious. They get paid whether they win or lose. And I make a lot of friends and have a lot of attorney friends. And it's not personal with them. They will go into battle, and then right after that, they'll be sitting up there having, you know, out there at Starbucks or eating some deer meat or something. Okay? It's not personal. It's not personal for me either. It used to be personal. You and I can both attest to the fact that we used to get angry because we didn't know enough, okay? But we know a little bit more now to be dangerous, and that was enough to be dangerous to get myself out of a person that wants, first of all, she wants to be more than what she is because she was stupid enough to ask me to refer to her as a damn judge. And I know you're not a judge, and which is why I teach my people on this show, identify, who are you? Are you a creditor? Or are you a debt collector? Can't be both. So once I identify you, I'm going to communicate and have intercourse with you on that level only. I'm not going to call a judge a magistrate. I'm not going to call a magistrate a judge. I'm not going to call a Puerto Rican a Dominican, and I'm not going to call a Dominican a Cuban. You have to know who people are and identify them appropriately, because with that identity comes rules and regulations and authorization, and that's what we need to know. So that's end of my story. I'm going to go to the calling line and pick back up, and Latif, stay on the line. We're going to answer some more of these questions and see what's going on out here in the community. Let's go to 661-0241. 661-0241, you're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question? 0241, do you have a question? Okay, those of you out there, if you don't have a question, why don't you go ahead and mute yourself out instead of pressing 1. Let's go to 412-1568. 412-1568, do you have a question?
Yes, sir. How you doing today, Sharif?
Doing good. How are you, bro?
Oh, always great. Always a pleasure to talk to you, always.
Yes, sir.
Question is... as far as, like, a lot of stuff that you're speaking about, and what's the other brother's name that's on the line also?
Brother Latif.
Latif, okay. A lot of stuff is, like, really good, but as far as an individual being a pro se litigant going into these courts, one thing that an individual needs to know how to do, and it'll be the question that I'll be asking you, is the process of when you're dealing with these foreclosures, the process of striking the complaint, the process of filing a motion to dismiss, and also filing a motion for a more definite statement. Now, in what order should an individual do their motion? Should they do the motion to strike first, or should they do the motion to dismiss first? Or sometimes they say there's a motion to quash.
Uh-huh. You have several motion practices that are available to you. One could be a demur. One could be a motion to dismiss. You know, a motion to the strike usually comes after or in conjunction with a motion to dismiss, in my opinion. Okay, and it's all about, you know, how you want to litigate. So I would first come in with a demur or a motion to dismiss, okay, and it depends on what you're striking. Are you striking parts and parcels of their complaint, or are you striking evidence? Are you striking, let me finish, are you striking the assignment, or are you striking a party? So, you know, go ahead.
One of the first things I probably would strike is I would probably strike the fact that the plaintiff is a stock certificate and the fact that the whole complaint is not verified. I would strike the whole complaint, and I would strike the real party's interest because it's a stock certificate. I would basically start there.
I would agree with you. I would agree that, but I wouldn't go after that in the manner of striking. I would just do a pretty well-pled motion to dismiss. And I would assert, you know, my basis for my motion far as not real party in interest, unknown entity, not a person, not an entity, not a true party, you know, things of that nature. But a motion to dismiss to me would be the first you want to go based on your procedural motions. Before you get into subject matter, I think if you dive too much into subject matter, you'll find yourself going down that road they want you to go. You just stick on the procedural violations before you even deal with anything. This person is not a real person. It's not a party of interest. The plaintiff hasn't pled, you know, where this entity exists, where they formed, under what law, under what state. This plaintiff is not a real plaintiff. You know, stick on those procedural issues on identity first, okay? Who are they? I don't think they exist, okay? So after you do that, and if the court comes back and says, well, you know, we're gonna not dismiss the complaint, it's been denied, then you want to go into looking at other matters about the complaint. Do you want to strike certain evidence in the complaint? Do you want to strike certain aspects of the complaint? If you listened to my show a couple of weeks ago, I actually took a case, a New York case that I broke down, and I read the entire complaint to the audience, and some of them were very surprised, and I received an abundance of emails that said, oh, Sharif, you know, that's the same kind of play that I got. And I broke down the complaint in its entirety so people could understand. Those complaints are not really complaints. They're fishing expeditions. They're pled for you to kind of fill in the gaps. So I agree with you, brother. There's a lot of different procedural ways you can go about it. But yeah, in the case of a certificate or an unknown entity, now you have to make sure they're unknown, because although they have some lengthy names, some of them are incorporated in the state of Delaware and in New York. If you look both places, most of those remics are in Delaware. So you go to the Delaware Secretary of State, look them up, get the registered agent, and go ahead and include them in your complaint.
Well, my question would be, you said I should go get that, or should I file production for them to produce that, or should I just, you know, I would be wanting to go get it myself?
Okay. Well, okay. Now you started from the beginning. Now you're going in the middle. So let's say the judge refused to dismiss the case, and now you've gotten to the point where, you know, the next thing you should be going for after an answer, the judge might be like, okay, well, I'm not dismissing the case. You've got 20 days to file an answer. So you'll file an answer, and then right after that, you should be going for summary judgment, saying that, look, I mean, there's no reason for us to go to trial. There's no issues of facts here. There's nothing that the complaint is lacking merit. It doesn't make any sense. And you want to go on that basis. But if you're saying that you're in some, like, you're knee-deep in the case and now you have to do a production for documents, you got to understand, I don't think you want to get that far, because they're also going to do interrogatories on you. Okay, which is what most of these cases do. The plaintiff will file this case. The case won't have any merit. They'll get you down to the point where it's time for discovery. And they're just going to ask you an interrogatory, say, admit that you ever got a loan, and admit that you executed this paperwork and documents. And they're trying to get you to acquiesce to the loan. And once you do that, then they're going to go for summary judgment. Okay, so you need to work hard to get a motion to dismiss, and in some cases you need to do an interlocutory appeal when you feel like a decision prior to trial is not favorable to you. You need to utilize that element as well.
You said an interrogatory appeal?
Interlocutory interlocutory appeal.
Interlocutory. Okay, I couldn't find
right.
that. That's maybe because I was putting interrogatory. And my last question.
Right.
My last question would be: when you do these motions to dismiss, there might be 20 different reasons or 15 different reasons. Do you do it one at a time, or you just put all 20 on one motion to dismiss? Because
all in one motion, and you don't all in one motion, and you just want to attack the most substantive violations or the most obvious. You don't listen. I'm not one that likes to have 20, 30 page responses. It is not necessary. Okay. And one thing I will say also, the way I try to bring the information to this network is that you don't have to use big words. You don't have to be fancy. And trust me, I wasn't in magistrate court. I mean, I can go up there on that level and really get highly articulate. But it's no need to, because I already know what I know, and I can speak very calmly. I might use a word or two here, a couple of key words, okay, that the legal society might be familiar with. But other than that, I teach people how to be real plain. I mean, so you have to look at it and be like, I don't know who this alleged creditor is. I do know I never executed a loan and a mortgage and note with them. The alleged evidence, inadmissible at that, that they have proffered to the court has no probative value. I don't know where that came from. They're not named on the documentation that they provided. Like, I don't even know. You have to act like this is somebody that you totally don't know. I don't know who the hell they are. I don't know what they're talking about. Okay? Now, you know, you're going to listen to my last call, because I go into what a notice pleading state is and a fact pleading state is. You need to know the differences, and depending on your state, you know, or if you're in the district court, then you have to do fact pleading. That means you have to, the complaint has to have a short statement of facts, okay? So, you know, you have to look into all those matters. So, brother, I can't tell you exactly how to litigate your case. I can only give you my opinion. I can't give you any legal advice. I can only give you my opinion. But I would say that you start off with a motion to dismiss and really go hard, okay, and then work your way up from there. And then if you find yourself knee-deep, you know, give me an email. Maybe I can, you know, give you a strategy or tell you how I would handle your situation if I was similarly situated.
Okay. Now, if you get your motion get denied, would you do a motion to reconsider, or you just move on to the next phase?
If you had a good basis to kind of tell the judge, hey, look, judge, now I threw down some heavy meat on the table. I really need you to look at that again before I consider an interlocutory appeal. You know, I respect your decision, but I just think my motion to dismiss has a lot of merit, and I think the court may be missing something to that extent. You know, be respectful, but tell them that, you know, if you feel like it's strong and the complaint is absolutely weak, yeah, you should do a motion to reconsider. It's not going to hurt, because what you want to do is set the record. You got to understand that this system is not designed. And let me make this clear. The system is not designed for you to win at the trial court level. It's just not. All right? It's designed for you to set the record, put all the evidence, put all the facts on the table, whether the judge ignores it, hears it, rules properly or not, okay? And you want to win your case on appeal, okay? You got to understand these trial courts are gatekeepers. They're there to try to knock you out before you say anything, and they're there to try to discourage you and distract you. But when you have your mind set that no matter what you do here, I'm just setting my case for appeal, set up for appeal, then you're going to have a better opportunity in the appellate court and the higher court should you decide to go further. All right, brother? I appreciate
you
call.
Know, appreciate it, man. You helped me out a lot. Like always.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate it. Thank you, man.
Right.
God bless. All right, let's go to 562-2518, 562-2518. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Yeah, peace, Islam, brother. Peace to the gods.
Peace, brother. All right.
Well, first question is, like, what do we owe anything to any of them? Because they actually, no one ever loaned you anything. Is that correct?
Let me see how I'm going to answer that. All right. I want to be real careful because, like I said, we've made a collective effort to try to answer these questions and kind of streamline information and kind of filter it. It is my belief that if you have intercourse with a banking association and you execute the proper documents and you're the recipient of some merchandise based on that transaction and you enjoy that merchandise, okay, I'm a businessman, okay?
Okay.
So if I give you services and you know, and we use Federal Reserve notes or we have a contract or we have a verbal agreement, I would expect that you hold your end of the bargain. So I don't want to be the one to teach us to say that, okay, I went out there and I got a $250,000 property, okay, and I'm living in it, okay, I'm not paying for it, and I'm going to turn around and then say after I've had intercourse with you, I've agreed to abide by the contract and its contents, okay, I agreed to pay you a sum of money. Okay, I agree to do it on a timely basis. I agree to a certain amount of payments. Okay, and I'm living and have possession of that merchandise. You did something. Let me finish, brother. You might have did something that I don't know how to do yet. Okay, I might not have learned how to execute my own instruments or do what you're doing. And until I get to that point, I got to play ball with you because I agreed to play ball with you. So when you want to look at it in its essence, no, they didn't loan you anything. I'll go ahead and say that. But you're not going to win that argument in court. That's what I'm going to tell you. Unless you have a way that when you know that they didn't loan you anything, or you may have been the creditor in that situation, if you don't know how to go and discharge that obligation in whatever manner you choose, when you get to the court, they're going to say, you got an obligation. Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. They didn't loan you anything. You got the house, right? You're living in it, right? You're driving around in the car, right? You put 22s on it, right? You put some TVs in it, right? You ain't paying for it, right? Well, who gave it to you? We ain't give it to you. That's what they're going to say. And you know what? In the public, that's what they're supposed to say. So if there's some way for you to do it in the private, brother, you got to learn that. Or listen to the people on this show that has that remedy and figure out a way before it gets to the public court venue to discharge that obligation privately or using whatever process and instrument that affords you to do so. That's all I will say on that, brother. But as long as you go in that court, they're going to believe that you got a debt, and if that's the only defense you go in there with, brother, you're going to lose. And I'm telling you, you have other defenses as far as breach of contract or the project wasn't executed properly or was in contradiction of state law or federal law or was discriminatory lending or anything. You got 100 things you can do, or they breached the contract, they sent me the wrong notice, okay? That's what I teach here, for us to be responsible for the obligations we did participate in prior to us coming into other information that we may not have done that transaction. But I can't give you that remedy now because I haven't learned a process yet, and I'm not saying they are not out there. I'm saying that it is out there. Okay, I've seen checks, brothers, from OIDs. I've seen people get hundreds. I've seen them. That doesn't mean I'm going to subscribe. I've also seen people go to jail. I'm not saying anything is wrong about any of those processes, but if it lands you in jail, there's something wrong with it from my perspective, because I don't think you should do anything that would put you in that situation, okay? So that's my take on it. When I learn a way to exit, and I will, okay, because I believe there are processes out there. I believe there are other ways to deal with debt. I just chose to deal with it this way so that I can help this community be able to get out of those contracts that we have or be able to resolve them and then move forward in a different way and in a different manner dealing with commerce, okay?
Right. And as far as, like, when you file, I guess, like, for void judgment or something like, you know, void judgment, do you notify all parties that were involved? Like, if it was like you notify the judge, and do you notify the other party that was involved? You know, from the beginning, it was the the plaintiff. Do you have to notify everyone?
If you're going to rule, you're talking about a Rule 60B motion to set aside or motion to set aside void judgment or something like that, yeah, you have to notify counsel who is responsible for obtaining a judgment on that. You have to notify the court, and you have to notify all parties. So you definitely got to serve them by regular mail, okay, serve them, or just do a certified just to make sure they got it. And, yeah, go ahead and have a good fundamental basis why that needs to be set aside. It could be new information you obtain. It could be fraud. It could be lack of service. Okay, it could be, you know, the plaintiff was not the real party in interest. You know, just read, you know, your 60B motions to set aside and pick one of those reasons. But read the rules and understand that there are only certain instances where you can do that. All right? Not
right.
Just
what
because
a, what
you
a,
now, Now, let me just say this and I'll let you go, brother. Many people have these cases and they were served and they didn't show up. Then they later find out they could have had a more favorable experience had they showed up. So they go to try to set it aside and the judge say, you had the time, you had the time to litigate. Like, you served, you didn't show up. Okay, so they're not going to look favorable on those things. Now, if you went and you lost and you obtained some information later that determined that the case was fraudulent or there were some erroneous allegations in there, now you got a good basis to go back and be like, well, Judge, I just discovered it. And I tried to say that while I was in the court, and you ruled against me. But here's some evidence that may have swayed your decision in a different direction.
And that would be done in the form of a writ of discovery. Is that right? Or
I understand the use of writs, and you know, and there's a lot of that going on. I don't do writs. I do discovery motions or, you know, production of documents, things of that nature. You can put a you can name it a writ if that's what you're comfortable with. But, you know, I use the terminology that's familiar to the court. Yeah, I mean, I just use a discovery motion, you know, whatever it is, a motion for production of documents, interrogatories, things of that nature, motion for deposition, okay? A lot of times when you set deposition for the – I'm telling you right now, I tell the people all the time, and I got four emails of people that's contacted me in the last month, and I told them, just go ahead. I said, look, just go ahead and do a motion for deposition of this robo-signer or this debt collector. And I'm telling you, when you start asking for deposition, they're going to start wanting to settle with you, okay? Because they don't want you getting into that. So we got to learn the discovery tools. We got to learn the litigation tools available to us to kind of squeeze them into a corner. All right, brother? I'm going to have to move on. I appreciate your call, brother. Hopefully it did something for you. And we'll see you next week. All right, peace.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to let me just tell y'all, we got 10 minutes left in the live stream. 10 minutes. If you are calling in or want to call in, you need to do so now. I'll go a little bit after, not too long, to try to get these questions out the way. Y'all know I have an obsession to try to answer all the questions on the board. I'm going to try to get to them, but we have 9 minutes and 52 seconds left. All right, and we're going to move forward. Let's go to 562-2518, 562-2518. You're on High Frequency Radio.
That's me, brother. You just muted me.
Okay, I'm sorry, and I thought so. Thank you. All right, let me go downtown. Let's go to 770-0805, 770-0805. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question, comment, or concern? All right. Yeah, a lot of.
So I'm back. I apologize to you and the audience because I lost signal. But
all right. Yeah, I wonder what happened to you. Okay, brother. Well, you on? I'm gonna leave you open, and we're gonna go answer a couple of questions. Let's go to Eric G. 01. Eric G. 01. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Yes. Peace to the gods and High Frequency family. How's it going?
Peace, brother. How you doing? We doing great. How's everything with you?
I'm doing good, brother. I'm here in the Tennessee Territories. I wanted to share a, I always send a shout-out to Brother Yusuf for preparing this platform and you guys for doing what you do. I want to share a story to let you know that I appreciate you, you know, just giving me that, I listened to you over and over and over. I was dealing with a property, a relative's property. I had talked to you a couple times on the show about it. Because the property was held in a trust, and we quick claimed it back to her person so we could do this process. And in Tennessee, we have non-judicial, so, you know, it's kind of tough over here because they'll steamroll you outside the courtroom to sell the property. So we've been holding it off for long, and they kept having a court. I mean, they kept having the foreclosure scenario, and I was listening to you, and I put in some documents to the judge for a I'm trying to think of the name of the, I don't have any docs in front of me, but basically just to get the judge to back them off, and because I was going to go into federal court on the,
okay,
you know, the whole thing. So the first time I put the notes in that I was going to do it, they backed off. It gave me another month. And then the second time I went into the courtroom, and it was with Nation Star Mortgage, and that clearly.
All right, clear. Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah. But they didn't even show up in the court. I just walked right up with the judge, and he basically looked at me, and he asked. He called out Nation Star Mortgage. They weren't there, and I made one mistake, but I solved it in the courtroom. I didn't have an order, you know. So
there you go, right. So, you didn't have a proposed order, right?
Right.
For the judge to sign off on. Okay.
Right. So I basically just took a piece of paper and wrote on it, signed it, and it held, and I mailed it off to Nation Star. So I do know that if you get that in there, so it was a permanent restraining order. It was a restraining order that I got on them, a restraining order. Permanent restraining
beautiful, order. Beautiful, man. That's beautiful, brother. I'm proud of you. Listen, that kind of stuff tickles me because Latif will tell you, I'm not really a public guy. You know, I've been on, like, Latif got me into doing this radio stuff and talking. And when Yusuf asked me to come on, he's like, man, you should do it. So, man, I'm not, man. I'll go talk in court. You know, I'll do seminars. I'll go talk. I talk to groups of people all over the country. But I wasn't coming and do no radio show and all that. But you know what, man, since Yusuf brought me into this light and he asked me to come on, I thought about going back in my hole because I have so much to do, and I chase that money, okay? So when I came out and I seen how the people just appreciated the information, how they were being uplifted, the amount of emails that I get, man, and the ones that I'm able to answer and give some slight direction, I'm getting emails every day that keeps me motivated. And it's calls and that, like you, callers like you that call in, man, we want to know the little things that happens, man. Because here you go, you got a restraining order, you're still in your home. Now you're on the offense. The bank didn't show up. I think what you were trying to say is you put in a notice of dispute that I had out there and a
right.
couple other things that I've shared. And right. and here we go. You know, they didn't show up. And, you know, a lot of times in injunction hearings or you know, they're ex parte. So really the banks sometimes won't show up. They usually do because they don't want you to get one. But they know that it's usually ex parte, meaning that the judge can rule on it. And usually there's no reason to fight it. But understand that those injunctions have a time limit on them. Injunctions may last 2 months. It may last 30 days. Usually they'll give you a permanent injunction, and then they'll set a sure cause hearing to see whether the injunction should be made permanent or not. So you're not all the way out the water, but, brother, you got a good step on them. Okay, because the judge seen some validity in what you're doing.
Well, I'd like to ask you this, too. They never, when I sent them the order, right, so to notice mm-hmm. them that I received it, I was expecting them, because they had like 10 days to challenge it, right, I think something like that, to challenge the order. So they never did that. So even though you're saying that's a hearing, is that done by the courts, or would Nation Star have had to force that hearing?
Oh, you said Nation Star had forced the hearing?
No, I'm asking you, would Nation Star have had to have forced the hearing, or would the courts just by those, whatever the rules are, when they give you an order, they're the one that will have a hearing again to review it? Is that going to happen?
And tell me if I'm right or wrong, Latif, but with injunctions, the judge is usually going to set an expiration date on the injunction and have a subsequent order to show cause hearing whether the injunction should be made permanent. Because many times what I've seen, Latif, is the injunction will be, okay, well, we're gonna give you the injunction to stop the foreclosure sale, and we're going to set a hearing in 20 or 30 days or whatever to determine whether the injunction should be permanent or not. So it's usually two phrases to that. Am I correct on that, Latif?
Yeah, absolutely correct. Typically it's called a TRO, temporary restraining order. And the word temporary means that it's for a period of time, 30 days, 90 days, 2 weeks, or whatever. And then you also move for a permanent injunction thereafter. Now, sometimes they can get into, well, you need to post a bond or something like that, you know. So it's very, very sweet when you can get it without posting bond. Okay?
Right.
The other thing is that I want to commend the guy for saying that he didn't go in there with a proposed order, but he took the time out to write it on a piece of paper.
That's right.
I presuppose that you got the judge to sign off on it. Is that correct?
He did. He said, this is not conventional. You know that. I said, well, Judge, I know it's not, but it's true. That's all I said.
Let me say something right quick, and Chief, I'll let you go back in. I want to say something to you right quick about that. Many of us don't know that you can write a complaint out in a pen or a pencil on a piece of paper. I've seen it. I've seen two, well, I call them patriots, but I pulled up their cases in federal court, and they wrote out their whole case on a blank piece of paper, crooked as hell, and wrote out their whole complaint in bad handwriting, and it was accepted. So you don't understand that. I know a lot of us think we have to go in court and we have to look like attorneys, sound like attorneys, write like attorneys. You don't. You really don't. Be yourself. Write what you're saying. Keep it simple. Okay? And you'll be okay. So go ahead, Latif. I'm sorry.
I want to let the audience know that I, too, was in that similar situation. I had to go to a court to get them to do a temporary restraining order. And what I submitted was insufficient. And they said, well, no, you had to go back. The clerk was telling me you had to go back and get this redone. I said, well, and that was like an hour and a half away from that courthouse. I said, well, let me ask you something. Do you got a piece of paper and a pen? I'll write it up right now.
There you go. Beautiful.
I did that. I did exactly that. I put the caption on there, everything else, called temporary restraining order, identified the parties and everything else, and it was presented to the judge, and she signed it right there on the spot. Okay?
Beautiful.
So what Malik is saying and what this gentleman has demonstrated is, again, I go back to the topic of procedure, knowing your rules, okay? You see, it can be typed and it'll get into font, but nothing said it could not be written. Matter of fact, there are prisoners who present their briefs or complaints from prison in a written format because they have no access to typewriter. So you cannot be denied due process because you don't have a typewriter or computer, as long as it's legible. Thank you.
That's right. Beautiful. All right, brother. Look, I'm happy, man. I'm elated that you had that result, and I'm glad that that came from information that we're trying to disseminate to the community, and I love demonstration. You get a lot of people ask a lot of questions and do a lot of things. I like my students. I like them to demonstrate. I want to hear what you're doing. I want to see the progress, and I'm glad that in a short amount of time that I've been here, that you're having some success, man. And once you get that confidence in you and you learn the rules and you know the rules, let me tell you something, brother. You're more dangerous than any attorney out there. Do you understand? And you're a threat to the ones that call themselves out of title, you know, want to call themselves a judge when they're a magistrate. Well, you know, I mean, no costume. I don't care what costume you wear anyway. There's no costume on this country that gives you any authority over me if I'm not harming someone. And I make that perfectly clear. I don't care what kind of costume you got on. You're still a man and you're still a woman. You still make mistakes and you still have emotions. And I am going to find what that button is, and I'm going to poke it. It's called antagonizing sometimes. Let me not preach that. Y'all don't be antagonizing anybody. But when you know the rules, what I'm saying is you're going to have a deep-seated confidence in yourself in knowing the rules. And I'm going to give you another example, brother. I appreciate your call, okay? And call us next week and keep us updated, brother.
I definitely will.
Thank you. And you know, I had a situation when talking about knowing the rules. There was a case I helped a good friend of mine. He was a good friend. Matter of fact, he was a fraternity brother of mine. And he had a criminal case. that was, you know, it was some felonies involved. And, you know, I started looking at his case, of course, we real tight, and I started helping him with his case, and I filed, you know, a couple of motions to have the case dismissed, right? So we went, you know, we said it, I had a motion to dismiss that sat on the calendar for 2 or 3 months, okay? And I know the time was coming close to have arraignment, right? So when it came time to have arraignment, I called the clerk and said, we have two pending motions there that needs to be heard. And they haven't been heard, but you already sent the notice. That was, and when we got the notice, it said to be in court in a couple of days, and it was dated for a month prior, so it hadn't been mailed out on time. These are the games that they will play with you because they know, they think that you don't know the rules, okay? And they think you don't know what you're doing. So I looked at the notice, I called. I said, clerk, why has this matter been set for the calendar prior to this? And she says, well, that's, well, we have the motion, but the judge just didn't set it for the calendar. I'd be like, well, I set it for calendar for hearing, and that wasn't done on your part, so that's not my issue. So she says, well, you can just go in, and this is the clerk told me, well, you can just go in and at arraignment and just tell the judge about it. I said, no, ma'am. She says, well, he's not going to set it because you already set for arraignment on Wednesday, and this is Monday. I said, clerk, with all due respect, I need that motion hearing set, and I need it set prior to arraignment because it's a dispositive motion. It may dispose of the case in its entirety. I'm not going to go to arraignment because I know when we get to arraignment, the judge is going to be like, look, this is for arraignment. We're not talking anything else. You follow what I'm saying? So she was sending me into a railroad situation. I said, clerk, unless you can tell me what rule you're relying upon to tell me that you can't go to the judge and set a hearing when I have a motion to dismiss that's been on the docket and should have been set for hearing, unless you can cite some rule or some case or something like that, I need you to go to that judge and have that hearing set for today or tomorrow, or you need to go ahead and continue and postpone arraignment. When I said that to her, she kind of paused. Hold on, okay? So she held on, and she said, let me have your number. I said, okay, here's my number. And she called me back. And she said, I'll call you back. Well, she called me back. Her whole tone had changed. And she says, well, the judge is going to go ahead and hear your hearing. He doesn't have court on this morning, but he set hearing especially for you. And you know what? When you're going into court, I want to tell the community, when you are going in court, if your stuff is tight, And I know you hear many people say that, and it is absolutely true. When they know they're going to be dealing with a skilled civilian or litigant or pro se litigant or whatever other affectionate term that they want to deem of you, they will set your case on a day that is either not too many cases being heard or on a day that is no cases being heard. So when I tell you, and I lie to you not, she set that hearing. She said the judge set a special hearing for you on this day and in court, and he had to redo his schedule. I said, oh, that's great. That's all I wanted. I thank you, and I appreciate you. So we went to court, and it was the most – and Latif, didn't I tell you about this story?
Well, we'll finish. You went to court.
I went to court with my buddy and me and him, and I went, and, we laced up, and we went up in there. And again, I read body language, and I tell everybody to read body language. So we went into the court, and we did a motion to dismiss, and they had charged him with some felonies for felony trespassing and damage to property. He had had a little spat with his wife, and, you know, they got into a little spat, and there was a gas can involved, and, you know, there was some, you know, a little bit of domestic issue there. And somehow a gas can was kicked over, and a cigarette wound up in the gas and burnt their garage. So, of course, the rambunctious municipal police department wanted to make a charge out of the melanated people and say that they tried to burn their house out, something like that. Anyway, they were charging felonies, and they were pretty serious felonies. I started looking at the affidavits. Of course, I started peeling apart the case, started looking at the affidavit and seeing that was defective, and they had him down as a resident. I said, well, prove that he's a resident of the state of, okay, he's not a resident. You know, I went into some jurisdictional issues. You know, I went into some procedural defects that he had in there. I went into some constitutional defects that was in the complaint. I put all that in it. It was about 8 or 9 pages. Heavy 8 or 9 pages. So we went in, Latif and the audience, we went in, we sat down. It was only, there was about 13 suits in there. And I'm not quite sure whether they're attorneys, all of them. They look like they were attorneys. Some court staff. It was some, you know, some, I guess some pretty important people in there. There was nobody else in the courtroom and the judge. And we went in. They called the case up. I told him what to say, told him exactly what to say, told him exactly what to do. I sat there in the front with them. The judge looked at that. The prosecutor was talking, and, you know, they were, and he's like, well, judge, they're moving to dismiss on these particular bases, and this is not the proper motion and not the proper procedure. You know, no, he's saying it's not a proper procedure to do a motion to dismiss. And he kept talking, and, you know, my buddy kept looking at me, and I kept giving him hands gestures. I'm like, look, just relax. I'm looking at the judge, Latif. You know, we know how to look when they go in a direction. They're not looking at me. They're looking down. They're a little bit pale-faced. I'm looking around, and I'm like, okay, everybody's trying to watch and see what's going on. So this was something where they were like, we got somebody before us that knows something. So he went through his thing, and the prosecutor went, and then my boy went, and I told him what to say, and he just started going at him. And the judge listened. He looked at the prosecutor, and he said, judge, can I say something else? And the judge says, you don't need to say anything else. You don't need to say anything else. You don't need to say. He said, well, judge, he said, we don't need to say anything else. He said, but this is what he said, and I noticed what was going on because we're in a court of record. He said, sir, I'm going to deny your motion. On the record, I'm going to deny your motion because of this or that. I forget what he said. And I already knew he was doing that for the record and to sort of save face on the record. But all the people that the 13 or 15 people that he had there, he just wanted to see who put together this motion and all these things, and he wanted to see who was it because he knew it was a melanated person. So he actually wanted to see who these so-and-sos coming in here with this. So when he says, I'm going to deny your motion and you know, we're going to set it for arraignment and everything. And I already knew in my mind, you're not going to set a special hearing for us, okay, when you have no cases on the docket. And deny our motion. I already knew that. I knew when she said he's going to set a special hearing for you, and that's, now you remember what I'm talking about. I already knew that it was merit to what we was doing. So we walked out. We got up. He looked at me. He was a little bit frazzled. I said, just chill out. I'm just telling you. I already know what's going to go on. They're going to dismiss the case. I thought they would dismiss it by letter afterwards. But when we walked out the courtroom, the prosecutor followed us. He says, look, gentlemen, he says, look, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go ahead and null process it. No, he said, I'm going to go ahead and, he said, I'm null process it. And I said, well, you know, I just really want to formally dismiss. I don't want to null process. And he says, oh, come on. He said, listen, I'm a null process it, and we'll just, you know, rid the case and end it like that. And that was it. And I looked at him. I wasn't surprised. And Latif, I'm sure you've dealt with situations like that. I was not surprised. But my buddy was surprised because he don't get in trouble, okay? And he didn't understand. He was scared as I don't know what. And when we left there, it was all procedural. It was constitutional violations. I made the threat that I would sue for the constitutional and due process violations. The affidavit wasn't executed properly. It wasn't based on personal firsthand knowledge. I mean, the same things that we deal with in debt collection. And he got dismissed 2 felonies, okay, based on procedural violations and the fact that he's not a resident of the state of Georgia. And that's the language that I put in there. So when I tell y'all, and this is experimentation, do you understand what I'm saying? Because and we have to learn how to see what works and what doesn't. But that's, I can say, specifically worked for me and worked for a good friend of mine. What say you, Latif, about that?
Excellent case. In terms of example, sometimes when you're going from civil action to civil action, the words are slightly different. And
right.
When you're trying to ask for a motion to dismiss, I had to learn the hard way, too, that it is a motion for nulli prosecuti. Okay? That's why he came back and said, I'm going to do a null process to you. Okay? So he understood what you meant. you know, that you use newly prosecuted. Now, don't prosecute this matter, just discard it, okay? And in civil action, we commonly call it, you know, a motion to dismiss the matter, okay? So effectively, you did the same thing. It's just that there was a slight of language, and so the other attorney was trying to play on that because, as you were saying, the audience there was picking up and said, what, you can come in here like that and do this? they don't want the cat out of the bag, like you said.
That's right. And, but let me say this now. I'm not an attorney. I'm not a criminal attorney, and I'll be honest with you. The only thing I look at, like, I don't want anybody to bow down to me. I'm just sharing with you various experiences. I've had experiences that didn't go favorably, but I'm sharing things that may uplift someone out there by sharing my experiences, what I've witnessed and experienced myself. And these are the, would I be able to duplicate that? Would it work all the time? Could I go ahead and put a notary stamp on that and be like, that's a procedure? I don't know, okay? I don't know. It worked for me in this particular case. And everything doesn't work all the time and everywhere. But those are just experiences. When you look at, when you know the rules, read the rules, and just look up some of the words that they're using. Look at some of the laws that they're quoting. Find the easiest ambiguity in the statute or the law and go after it with veracity. And be like, I don't know. It says person, but what type of person? Or it says may, and that, does that mean must? What is that saying? So, you know, those type of defenses are available. But let's go to the line. I got a couple of more callers, not many. Let's see if we can get a couple of men while you're here, Latif. Hold tight. We're going to go to 7330. You on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question? 7330-913. All right. Let's go to 443-0862. 443-0862. You on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Peace, Brother Sharif. This is Miguel Mario Bay. How you doing, brother?
Good, brother. How you feeling, Mario?
Very, very blessed, man. I'm really, truly appreciate you, man. I really do love what you're doing, man. Very professional. What you bring is very important, especially having a issue of, you know, coming from the consumer standpoint, because a lot of us are listed as consumers, and I really don't
That's
understand
right.
what producer means. Like, I was, when I went, I'm going to make it short because I have a specific question, and it might be off topic. But actually, I'm just asking you that. You have the process, along with your process, and I don't know if you're involved in it, and I apologize if you've addressed this already, of doing, claiming like homes, basically doing the same process that the bank does. I don't know why people don't just explain it like that. But that's, you know, claiming homes through default of what the bank does. Do you have a process like that? Do you go through that? What would you suggest?
Are you speaking about adverse possession?
Adverse possession, yes.
Okay. That's a topic, I'll be honest with you, and I appreciate the sentiments and the compliments, brother, and definitely I'm appreciative that you're appreciative of what we try to bring here, not only on my show, but on the network as a whole. Adverse possession is something that, yes, I do know about. It's something that if you are not familiar with, our priest Elishua is what he did was adverse possession, and he knows that in and out, and that's what landed him in a RICO case and had him in jail for almost 2 years, although he was able to beat his case substantively. I think adverse possession is something that needs to be reserved for people that really, really, really have an understanding of that. And it would be ill-advised of me to go into that and put that out there to a community that consists of highly intellectual people, some people with a great understanding of those things, and people that don't have much understanding because it's going around a lot. I mean, I know of right now 6 people that's in jail in separate states for doing efforts adverse possession. Now, understand me. They done it right, okay? And this is why I speak with Latif and let y'all know, right doesn't mean they're going to accept it, okay? So adverse possession, they've been, it's about a half a dozen people I know I've gotten calls about have done it, taking million-dollar houses, multi-million-dollar houses. I wouldn't advise it, brother, unless you have not only a fundamental, good fundamental basis of knowledge on that, but an extensive knowledge of that process, because they're not gonna be too kind to people going out there taking houses when some of your neighbors next door is paying their mortgage. Let's just look at the morality of the issue, okay? And, you know, I've bought houses in the past, okay? And I wouldn't want somebody just coming out and be like, I'm going to throw in a couple of piece papers and, man, let's buy this house. Man, what? I've been working all these years paying for my mortgage, and you just going to do a couple of piece papers? Now, I understand that you can do it, and, brother, you can. And I think when you get to the point where you understand it, there may be some webinars that are available to you for people that really deserve to get that information. We can't put all that information out on the air. We have to be responsible, man, for that type of advanced information. It has to be vetted. It has to be researched. And it has to be done when it comes through us as leaders. We have to be able to translate it. We have to be able to research it. We have to be able to experiment it so that not only it can be done right, but it can be done without repercussion, all right? And that's why I wouldn't give you information such as that, because I don't want you to take that information and go do it, although it's right, although it's on the books, okay? There's a lot of things on the books. Guys, we can't walk the street without breaking a law. Do you understand what I mean? There's a lot of things on the book, and it's called law, statute, code. You understand? So, you know, I told a magistrate that one time on a traffic issue many, many years ago. I said, Judge, I can't even walk outside without breaking the law. So, and none of you in here can tell me that you don't, throughout the course of your day, break some laws. So let's stop trying to act like this is all serious. It really ain't. You know, there's enough laws on the books. I think there's, what, 4,000, 5,000? I don't know the number. But I wouldn't get into that with you on the phone. I wouldn't put that information out there if I knew it, unless I was able to speak with you and converse with you and determine that you have a great understanding of that, and you know how to execute that without being subject to a crime. So, but it is out there. A lot of people have done it. Gentleman that was just on my show recently, he did it. But yeah, as you can see, as wise as he was and as knowledgeable as he was, he still stayed in a cage for 2 years. And that's just something I don't think you're willing to risk just to get a property.
I understand.
Okay, bro. I didn't mean to avoid your question, but I'm just being honest with you, and that's my job. That's my job, man, is to be honest.
Can I comment on what you just said?
Yes.
I think my father used to always tell me, word to the wise is sufficient. Now, having said what Malik said and supporting it, yes, there are people who show the whole process for doing it. The risk you run is being able to support it. And, you know, when you go to do something like that, I would think that if you're going to do that, you probably need to teamwork. That's when you need to team up with an attorney. Have the attorney file it and everything else, the documents, also in these adverse possessions. I understand that when you do it, you need to show that if it's property you don't owe, that you added some type of value, i.e. you have either mowed the lawn, done some repairs because someone else wouldn't do it. It was, you know, and so therefore you're taking it over because of abandonment, okay? So it comes under the abandonment law, okay? Now, but having said that, if you were to take that on, then that is the time to get out of your pro se or doing it on your own as a non-attorney, but have an attorney involved with you so you have some type of shield, i.e. that the attorney was able to assist in filing the records or making the charge or whatever, so that you're not just out there naked, because you're going to find very few legal representatives that will be able to help you in case something goes awry. All right? So,
right.
Word to the wise is that it is a very, very slippery slope to go down, okay? Although other parties are doing it, notice that they're shielding themselves with attorneys and everything else to give the appearance that what they're doing is strictly legal and other people are about safe and for them, all right? And I know that sometimes our intent is to pick up a property free and clear, and, you know, sometimes it's not what you do but how you do it. But that would be the only advice I would say, that if you go down that path, see if you can find some attorneys, real estate attorneys, that can assist you in filing the documentation.
Right. And let me tell you something. Don't think you have a hard time finding some attorneys to do some shady stuff. You understand what I'm saying? As long as they're getting a cut, they are the shadies of the country. So don't think, you know, you won't find one. I'm just telling you, you think it's taking all these properties, okay? You'll be surprised. It ain't the banks. You understand? It's some attorneys out there, myself and Latif knows, that were one-man, home-confined attorneys that were making $20,000 a year, that since this real estate fiasco got some pretty good money stealing properties, okay? Creating these organizations and these trusts and these entities that swooping up properties, and now these guys is riding around with Bentleys. I'm like, isn't that attorney? So what the hell happened to him? What do you settle a big lawsuit? No, they stealing properties. Do you understand? And they're stealing them abundantly. So don't think you won't find an attorney, okay, that will find a way for you to do some things that is not necessarily favorable to most public officials. You also have to take into effect that a lot of these judges pay in mortgages. A lot of these law enforcement people, they're paying their rent. They're paying their mortgages. So you already going with a disadvantage if you happen to get caught up in that. Because it's like, you just going to take a house and I'm sitting up here paying my mortgage? You see what I mean? So it's just so much on the dark side dealing with that. And then, you know, it's also my job and my obligation to kind of bring some chlorine to our community, because we have labels as being thugs, okay? Moorish people being, you know, above the law, the sovereign thing is connected to that term, stealing properties is connected to that term, having fake IDs, you know, those things might not have any merit, but it projects the illusion that we're some sort of fraudulent society that just wants something for nothing. They already consider us the 47%, the way Romney says, you know, that's dependent on the government. So, you know, they already have a view, a picture painted of us, and we want to get away from that. And we want to show that we can be productive, that we can learn the judicial system, that we can learn their jobs, because the power is in the people, okay? And I had to tell somebody that. I forget who I had to tell that. And it's like, it's my job to keep the government intact. It's not the job of the government to keep the people intact. Where do you get that from? I mean, I don't know who told you that. Maybe the person that you hired, but it's my job to make sure you stay on your square. That's what I was telling that magistrate. It's not your job to keep me on point. It's my job to make sure you stay in your lane. Okay? When you have the rules and you know them, then you'll be able to do so. I appreciate your call, brother. Did I answer? Will we answer that?
Yeah. Just one quick question. That's why it involved the bank. That's why I said like the banks are doing, because I'm saying, because I know it's procedure. So is it a way, a process, or a place to study their procedure, at least, to know how to, you know, these banks are even claiming these properties? Because I know that, you know, a bank can't own property. So if they're, you know, the party that is in control of it, and it has to be through some type of process. And that's what I want
to
know.
Well, you're absolutely right. The law supports the fact that banks can't own property, but they do. You're not going to be able to get away with what a bank does. Let me just go on and be real with you. You're not going to be able to do what they do. You know what I mean? And you don't have that power. You don't have the financial backing. You can study the way they do it all day long, but what they're going to do is when they see you doing it, they're going to sic the law on you, okay? And then nobody on the jury, brother, listen to me. Let me not say nobody, but very few on a jury is going to understand that you went into a neighborhood, took a $250,000 property with $12 of documents. I'm just saying, it might be legal. My man, nobody, they're going to paint that soul, they're going to paint a Picasso on you to make it look wrong. Be like, this man in y'all community where y'all paying your mortgage, he just came in there and did a couple of documents for $20, $30, $50, $100, and now he owns a $250,000 house. They're not going to let you, first of all, alter that perception that everything you get you have to pay for and you have to come through them to do it. And they're not going to let you, a melanated man at that, be able to go out there and get properties that way. A few may go through, my brother. Some people may do it. You understand what I mean? They may do it under the guise of a LLC, of a trust, to where their identity is protected. if you're going to do something like that, that's probably one of the ways that you want to do it, not in your own name, okay? If you want to listen to Brother Youssef's show, he has a lot of ways for you to be on that private side, for you to be able to operate with those trusts, those LLCs and other asset protection vehicles. The brother that was on the show yesterday, JT Bay with the IRS, he has the knowledge of that. So if you're going to do those things, like Latsi said, I would get an attorney and I would get a protection vehicle like a trust or an LLC or an I-8 number, and I would go about putting those properties in that particular vehicle that way, so you have least of the blunt of responsibility for those actions.
Yeah, I already got the trust.
Okay. Let me say about trust because we talk a lot about it. Not specifically on my show, but you'll hear it on Youssef talks a lot about it, okay? Because he has a requisite knowledge of that. He knows how, and he always tells you, yeah, there's a private side and there's a trust, but there is an education that goes along with that. He could teach you how to. I think he had a seminar telling you how to get the numbers, how to get it structured, how to get it up and running. But then you still have to have knowledge on how to act within that trust vehicle. So it takes a good bit of dedication, my brother, and hard work to master that, because nobody gets rich overnight. You ain't going to learn this stuff in one webinar, one seminar, or read one piece of paper. You have to make it your goal. You have to make it your duty. You have to make it you have to claim that as, look, this is what I want to do. I want to make a go at it, and I'm going to learn everything I need to learn to be able to get those properties and keep them and not go to jail doing it.
Well, I'm well aware on, you know, I'm an adept in natural law. I know law of habit. I know how long it takes, and I'm very careful with the things I do. But, yeah, a lot of that issues, I'm with you 100%. I understand exactly what you're saying. I understand why you're saying it. I take calculated risks. I came from a financial services background, so I take
That's good, brother. I just want to, you know, what you're going to get here with me is that I'm always going to put you on caution. Okay, when doing things that I feel that I've seen, you know, that I've seen hurt people, I'm always going to be on the cautionary side first, because my commitment is to yourself and the rest of the people here to make sure that what we do it properly, we do it safely, and we always have an alternative route just in case it's not accepted in the way we deliver it. So, you know, I'm going to always, you know, stay on the wise side and be like, just research, you know, and know what you're doing, and do it as by the law as possible, and make sure you have some sort of a safety net just in case things don't go your way. I'm going to have to move on, brother. I appreciate your call. Hopefully that helped. Latif, thanks for that answer as well. All right, we're going to go another 15, 20 minutes. I got a couple of more calls here, not many. I might be able to get to all of them. Let's go to 206-0253, 206-0253, you're on High Frequency Radio.
Good morning, gentlemen.
0253. Yes, I can hear you, brother. Peace. How are you doing?
Greetings, Brother Sharif and family on the call. I have a couple, a friend who had a foreclosure sale, but prior to doing the foreclosure sale, they were able to enter a claim to the district court based on the Fair Debt Collections Practice Act and the information that you had been sharing and the law within it. During that, they actually filed the claim in the district court. The next day was the actual foreclosure sale. Now, what they did do based on a strategy was to get the claim filed, make sure it was served upon the defendants, and then go back to the court and make sure the court recognized that they served them. And then they showed up at the foreclosure actual trustee sale the next day. What the goal is which way should we move in the interim? Because now we're in the process where the defendant should be either submitting an appearance to the docket and then an answer. But what the couple wants to do is to protect themselves from possibly being evicted or having to go through a process where the title gets converted. Do you recommend not as a legal advice, but maybe an injunction, or should they move possibly forward for a motion and bring it up to hearing to have the federal side prevent any further movement on title while the process continues to go through? I hopefully shared this in a succinct way where it makes sense.
Great. Well, greetings, brother. First of all, honors to you. I'm glad you are taking it upon yourself, man, to be uplifted by the information that's shared on this network on multiple issues and topics. And I like to see people engaged. There's nothing that gets me more motivated than to help somebody that's already engaged and trying to help themselves. And I appreciate that opportunity. Now, it's a couple of things I'm concerned with your dissertation, and it's the language. And I understand that there's a lot of language out there, and there's a lot of words and keywords. And Latif and I, we spend so much time studying cases and, you know, going over procedures. We have a lot of that jargon, legal jargon, that we're able to reciprocate to one another and know what's going on. Now, you said that you're obviously in a non-judicial state. There was a foreclosure, and you said that the sale already occurred, and you filed something. Now, you said a claim, and I'm translating that to mean you filed some sort of a complaint in the federal court based on some consumer protection laws, and you served them, and you're waiting for the service to go through and the time to expire by which they have to file an answer. Meanwhile, it seems like they went on with the non-judicial foreclosure sale and went on ahead and foreclosed. So you're asking me, what should I do now that they've already conducted the foreclosure? Did I understand that correct?
Partly, yes. Actually, the situation is a group of people out of Georgia. I'm here in Washington. And what happened actually is that they've submitted a claim or a case in the district court prior to the foreclosure sale, and the sale happened shortly after that. Prior to the foreclosure sale taking place, they did enter the claim into the district court using the Fair Debt Collections Practice Act and the Georgia Codes as the foundation to attempt to prevent a non-judicial foreclosure sale of their property. They literally served it on the defendants and returned back to the district court to make sure the district court understood that they served it. They
okay.
then showed up.
Okay, you can stop there.
Court.
I got you. Okay, I got you there, brother.
Okay.
The filing, and I'll let Latif go on the second half of this question. This is my opinion on it. You know, if you file a case that has some merit, usually the banks are going to back off and not do the foreclosure sale. If you file something and they'd be like, we ain't worried about that, then they're going to go through with the foreclosure, okay? The only thing that is going to stop a foreclosure is, one, that you serve them with something heavy that has bat-like qualities that will knock them upside the head and be like, oh, shoot, like these people are serious. Like, we're really looking at some serious liability. Or you file a bankruptcy or get an injunction. Okay, as the gentleman that called in earlier, he was able to get an injunction to stop the sale, at least temporarily, of the property. If you don't do that, you're not going to be able to stop a foreclosure. Even if you have to file a shadow BK, which means that's just a BK, and I don't advise you to abuse the bankruptcy system and be filing false bankruptcies and dropping them just to stop a foreclosure sale. I always tell you that they will sometime lock you up for doing that. These trustees are looking for that. They know that people are going in there and the filing fee is $350. They're putting $100 down. They're stopping their foreclosure sale. They're wasting the court's time. They never pay the remaining $250. So they feel like you coming into their restaurant, ordering something, and only paying part of the bill and you're leaving. And that's essentially what you're doing. So don't abuse the bankruptcy. If you're going to go in there and you're going to do that, file your $350, whatever their charge is, to utilize their system, and you can file your bankruptcy. And if you decide to change your mind, you should be afforded that opportunity. But it shouldn't be consistent. So you could have filed the BK.
Okay, excuse me, Brother Sharif.
Go ahead, brother.
And I understand that, and I listened to your call based on the BK.
Okay.
That's not the situation
okay.
here. The actual claim has been filed, and what
mm-hmm.
I was asking you, because the attorneys moved forward and did do the foreclosure sale, at this point the family is attempting to do something within the case that is already filed in the federal court to try and prevent some title being moved. So my question to you is there, should the family file an injunction, or in my experience, I've been taught to move in the court with a motion and bring that motion up for hearing, the goal being to support the case that has already been filed and hopefully prevent the entities from trying to transfer title. That's my question.
Okay, I got you. I'm going to give you one or two sentences, and I'm going to let Latif come in because he's also a great strategic mind as well. This is what I'm saying. I don't know what case you filed. I don't know if it was a wrongful foreclosure is one of your causes of action, or it was consumer protection laws, FDCPA, FCRA, state laws. I don't know what your complaint entailed, but I will say this. It's no sense of filing an injunction now because they've already sold the property. So they're going to do a trustee deed upon sale or whatever instrument they use in your state saying that titles already changed hands because they conducted, even if erroneously, a foreclosure. So I think the time has extinguished whereby you can challenge the sale because it's already happened. I would say you need to rely upon the sufficiency of your complaint, and if you have any causes of action that are deemed wrongful foreclosure, then they may – sometimes they'll conduct the sale, and if you file suit even a day after, they'll reverse it, and they have the power to do that. But I'm going to let Latif go ahead and give you his take on your situation. Latif?
I appreciate that, Brother Sharif. I just want to make sure, Brother Latif.
Oh, yeah, man. And look, you got two brothers on the phone that should be able to give you a direction to go on, and there's nothing wrong with your question. I'm glad you took the time to make it plain for me because I definitely needed that. So, Latif, go ahead. What do you think?
Well, again, I want to say that these are some food for thought, not that I'm being your legal advisor at this particular point. I do want to commend you that I think that you have a pretty good concept of procedure and law, and I want to commend you for that, okay? Now, addressing the specific things that I heard, number one, we want to go back to the fact that you served them on time. So you have a jurisdictional issue, that the issue alleged against the foreclosure on the FDPCA 15 U.S.C. 1692F6 is within the jurisdiction of the court to determine the veracity of it, okay? So that in itself gives you a wrongful foreclosure case, all right? Number two, what Malik said was very, very important. There's nothing that doesn't prevent you from asking them to listen. You're already in litigation. Okay, we will seek additional damages because you were given notice, but you continued. Okay, and you can show that is a abusive act for abusive litigation.
And an anticipatory breach.
That becomes a statutory breach and it becomes a tort breach. So you can ask them if they wanted to rescind that sale voluntarily, or there'll be other arising action because of it. All right.
Now, what I'm asking: should a motion be filed in the court to bring it up for hearing to discuss that in front of the court, or should a document be sent to them explaining that?
No, I would suggest that you threaten them. Use the power of threat and doubt. You want to create fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Okay? I do not like TROs, especially in the federal court.
That's right.
Because most of the time you're going to be turned down. Okay? So, and if the TRO goes against you, they're going to say, well, the judge basically gave us a pass. We didn't do anything wrong. So you don't want on record that a TRO went against you.
It's denied. Mm-hmm.
So you got a 50-50 chance with a TRO. Those are not strong enough odds for me. Okay? If you do not ask for the TRO, temporary restraining order, a motion wherefore, okay, you have the strength of your argument showing the facts, the relevant facts, by timeline, when they were served and when they had knowledge, and yet they blatantly went forward.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I understand that clearly. They I think that's called knowingly doing something against the law when you've been informed about it. I've seen that before. Thank you.
Okay. So let me take a case. I think the first step is to tell them that you notice that they've conducted the sale. They have 5 days. You give them a 5-day notice to reverse it. If not, that become another issue for probable cause of abusive litigation. Okay, because of the harm, the tort harms that they created by ignoring statutory laws. Okay, and that's a breach of legal duty. Matter of fact, you're saying that there was a legal duty for them to refrain, even without getting the PR. Okay,
I understand that clearly, and thank you both for.
Okay, brother. Before you end that up, I don't think you still got the answer. Let me, and you got a lot of reasons for what you're doing, but I think what you're asking specifically is how do I bring this matter to the court's attention? I don't think it's really anything else you can do other than you filed your complaint. What are you going to set for hearing? The only thing you can set for hearing in that court is an injunction. What I would do is send a communication directly to the bank or the debt collector, creditor, whatever mask they're wearing, and say, look, I understand that you conducted and I have to see your complaint to see whether you gave them enough to say to themselves, oh man, if we sell this property, we're going to probably face some liability. I don't know if you put a list pendants on the property. These are all things you should have done simultaneously and contemporaneously when you filed that complaint, is you need to have a list pendants on the property. It's not a bullet, but it's something. Okay, it puts some sort of a cloud.
There's nothing that doesn't have him on it now. He can still put a list pendants on there.
That's right. He still can. That's right. But the only thing you do, my brother, is do an injunction, which, you know, like Chief told you, his choice, and I don't believe in them. I've done them years ago, but I don't believe in them. Or, you know, you have to send a notice and say, look, if you continue in any transfer of title while this issue is pending before the court, it may not be favorable. You may not have a favorable outcome. And just give them something, you know, whether it's a debt validation dispute or something like that, and give them something to list to think about. A lot of times they reverse those sales. You need to look at how the sale turned out. Did it revert back to the bank? Which, you know, I'm going to tell you right now, when you're putting up any challenge towards these debt collectors and banks when they're foreclosing, if they sense that you putting up any defense, sending them some notices, and they may have some issues to answer to down the road, they will always sell those properties back to themselves and not sell it to a third party. Understand that the third party, they want the money because there's people out there that's got some heavy change that will buy these properties, okay? So when you see them reverted back to themselves, that's because, one, it might be a property they want to keep. That might be the issue. Or two, it might be a property they say, well, look, we're not going to sell that to anybody else, because they sell it to somebody else and they deal with somebody like Sharif, then they're going to be caught up in some litigation for years to come, and then we don't want that person who we sold it to suing us for selling us a property that had some issues, okay? So you have to look at that. But I would say that, brother, either an injunction, or I would say go ahead and get you a bankruptcy attorney or a consultant and go ahead and take them in there and go to town with them in bankruptcy court, because you still have 10 days, you know, in bankruptcy court, even if they sold the property. So that would be my suggestion, is to go ahead and BK, deal with everything at once, because most people going through foreclosure, they have other debt issues, they have other credit card issues, they have other issues they need to deal with. Go ahead in bankruptcy court and know how to use those tools, and you'll be very effective there than you would be, I believe, Latif, in district court.
Because you're talking about title and contracts and everything else.
That's right.
And the bankruptcy court can handle that. And I think that's a very powerful suggestion, what you've said, and do the adversarial proceeding there. Also, what he has to understand is that just because they've done the sale, they now have to still come back and do the dispossessory action. Well, guess what? You now have other court cases that become precedent cases or cases in front of it, priority cases in front of it to determine who has rights to title before it is dispossessed. Now, I think you said it was a Georgia property. It was a Georgia property. We have what is called plea in abatement.
Georgia, yes.
Okay, so plea in abatement, if they try to take that into a dispossessory court, you go in there with plea in abatement and say, you need to stay there, stop this, because there's other courts that are determining the veracity of this action, okay? And now is not the time for this, okay? And even the magistrate courts have been ruling very favorable in plea and abatement when you establish that there's something that has started prior to that action of dispossession.
And I like that. And that's something, Latif, I'm going to invite you to come back on the show to kind of introduce and go over, which what you and I know is a plea and abatement. We'll make that a focus of our next show or our next two shows to discuss plea and abatement, which is another offensive action that one can take. So, Carl, I hope we help, but you know I'm always available by email, and I do a pretty good job of trying to get to every email. I also want to say to the chat, I have to apologize to you, and I sincerely apologize, because I haven't acquired the skills to do like my co-hosts, Youssef and Savage, and be able to work the studio and the chat line. So I know I hear, you know, Youssef and Savage and them, they be going in, they be talking, they be sending documents on the chat, they be just multitasking. I haven't gotten to that position yet, so I apologize. I love you all in the chat, and I know I missed a lot of chat messages to me. I promise by next week I'll start to practice and be able to utilize the chat line, because I have just as many people on the chat line than I do on the call line, so I have to pay you guys some attention and be able to address some of your questions on that other screen there, so I apologize. I'm going to take one more question, and then we're going to get on out of here. Latif, I appreciate you staying for the duration. Let's go one more question. Let's go to 317. 317-1342, you on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. I just don't know how to really phrase it.
Take your time, brother.
In a case, first of all, it's my peace to the gods and goddesses. In a case that I'm into right now, which probably wound up being dismissed, but when someone makes an allegation of intimidation in a public meeting, and then get five people to corroborate that, and a detective takes this, takes their statements, or take them downtown and look at the pictures, because I got had a criminal case in the past, was really a civil, but they see the picture, they point me out, and I've never talked to the detective, the investigative detective of the case. And based upon what they said, they put a probable cause affidavit out there and then arrest me. Okay, in the process, I bond out. The person that, the main one that accused me of this, he tells them that he's in fear of his life. Now, I haven't been in front of none of the witnesses. I haven't been in front of him after the bail reduction hearing. And none of his witnesses has been to any of the court dates, not even him himself. And his last one, the judge, they had a pro tem judge, and he could make no rulings on it because he's a pro tem judge, and he had to wait and let the judge that was been presiding over it deal with. So they gave me a May date, which I'm ticked. Plus, I'm on GPS. My question is, I have a public defender who is ticked, too. He's upset because he wanted to throw the case out. The prosecutor, they done had three prosecutors on this case. None of them was able to talk to the guy, really, that accused me of it. She doesn't have any intercourse with him or the witnesses, and the judge, well, like I said, protein judge, he wouldn't throw the case out. What can I do to make this thing come to a quick end? Because they ain't got no case.
All right. Well, Yeah, that's a good question, and that's a criminal matter, and I'm going to take your question in short because I can hear the desperation in your voice to want to get that off of you, and I totally understand. When you got the state coming right. after you, man, and they got you all tied up and got you wired up like a TV with antennas and GPSs, that is not a comfortable position, and it's not a position right. I want anybody to be in. So I'm going to try to guide you through and let Latif throw something in, but I really, really honestly suggest, because I like to stay in my lane. My lane is mostly on the civil side. I share right. with you an experience out of many experiences that I deal with on the criminal side, but it sounds like you just have a paper case and it's really nothing. But unfortunately, brother, you got to go through that. You got to ride that lane. And that lane is you got to get to a certain point where you're going to have arraignment and you're going to have hearings and you're going to have, you know, all those. I know you want it all for you right now, okay? And yeah, I can understand that. I know you do, and I know your attorney, probably, hopefully he's being sincere, and he says, man, I thought I was going to get that thrown out, and I am going to get it thrown out. But sometimes it's just the system, man, and the system works like an eight-cylinder engine, and sometimes you got to hit all cylinders until it fires up and you get on out of there. What I would say is that, you know, call Brother Youssef tomorrow. I mean, he has a way that he deals with public defenders. I believe he says his belief is to accept a public offender. And it seems like you have, and you probably didn't yeah. have a choice. Mm-hmm. A lot of times assign that to you. So I believe he supports that. But, you know, I would say that, you know, apply. Let the public defender either do what he do, or you need to know what he needs to do. And I would say Youssef right. would probably be better to tell you all of those things, because I really don't focus wholly on that area. But I don't want to lead you down any other route or tell you what to do. It's a serious matter. I wouldn't tell you to challenge your public defender and fire him. You know, that's only something that more experienced, advanced people are able to do. Latif, do you have anything that you can give to the brother that will aid him in his dilemma?
You know what? You're absolutely correct in this regard. We don't want to walk a fine line here, because your freedom life is on the line about being locked up. Okay?
Right.
But what you have said is that you haven't gone to arraignment yet. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Now, let me just tell you a little procedures that I'm familiar with about arraignment. Arraignment is trying to make you aware of the charges, okay?
Right.
Well, you're going to act a fool. That's the best place to act a fool. Okay, because the problem is, let me say, I'm saying this tongue-in-cheek, but let me say this. The law is that you go to arraignment and they're explaining what the charges are, and they're going to ask you, do you understand what you're being charged with?
Right.
And what would your response be?
No.
No, I don't understand. I don't even understand how I got here. You know, I don't understand what this is all about. Okay?
That's right.
I don't think none of this is valid. You know, this should be a no prosecuting. Yeah, I think you
okay.
guys got the wrong person.
Right.
Okay.
But again, brother, you gotta give them something. You gotta, you know, like if you were on the civil side, I'd be like, okay, well, you saying I damaged somebody, I'm gonna start moving for depositions and start subpoenaing some people to come in here since they said I've injured them monetarily.
Where's the injured party here? You got me arraigned, but where's the injured party? I have the right under the Constitution, under the Sixth Amendment, to face my accuser.
Right.
So
that ain't happened yet.
Identifying. I haven't been in the lineup. I haven't seen the person. I reserve all comments until I see the accuser.
And you can even
say,
I don't even know if this person even exists, or whether he's a fabrication of somebody's mind. I don't know this individual. I don't know who he is. I'm looking at the affidavit. It appears to be defective. He appears to not be saying anything. Okay? I just think
So your standpoint is, I don't understand this. I don't understand why I'm here. I don't understand the charges, because I don't know how it relates to me. Okay?
Right.
All right?
I got
that. And that's what you hang your hat on. And then he said, well, other than that, I plead the fifth.
Right. Okay.
Okay?
All right.
And
build a relationship with your public defender, man. Not all of them. Listen, we talking, my chief and I, we
don't want them to enter in a no guilty plea or anything like that, because then you're toasted. Then you're saying, well, you have pled. You know, you got to say that, no,
right.
I don't understand. And your public defender, see, is there because the public defender is trying to represent you. So you're saying,
right.
You know, out of courtesy to this court, I have there's a public defender. I don't even know why I got them. Okay?
Right.
I'm indigent, and they said I got to have them. But I don't understand none of this because, as I'm saying to the court, and remember, when you go into a criminal hearing like that, it presupposes it's recorded.
Right.
Okay? So that's your advantage. You say, you know,
okay.
You can take the defendant, you can, you know, you can stay him from working with me or whatever the case is, but I do not enter any plea right now until I understand, and this public defender hasn't made me understand, and there's not enough evidence to make me understand why I'm here.
Okay. I got that. All right, brother. All right, brother. I hope that's good enough, man. But I would definitely advise you to, you know, contact Youssef at highfrequencyblogtalk@gmail.com. You know, that's one of his lanes that he spends a lot of time on, between him and maybe Brother Savage and a couple of the other guys that are out there. They may be able to give you a course of action. But, you know, I deal with mostly the civil debt collection side. But, you know, I think the advice that we've given you, the opinion that we've given you is well.
It's
well,
your point of direction. Right.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate it, brother, and hopefully that helped. And good luck to you, man. And keep us posted,
too.
Is where your family here? We want to know what's going on, man. And don't be afraid to ask us anything. If I can't answer it, I'll get you to somebody. I know enough people, okay? I'll get you to somebody to get you an answer. So it's just convenient that, you know, the main host, the primary host of this network, you know, he deals in that. So give him a call or an email, all right? I appreciate it. We're going to cut off here in 2 minutes. Latif, much honors to you, my brother. I love you. Thank you for being here and assisting me today. I want to tell all the high-frequency radio listeners, thank you for making the show relevant, and I hope everybody is being uplifted by the information that's being given. We are blessed as a community, as melanated people, as we have the ability to do things that no other species on this earth is able to do. We are smart individuals by nature. I'm not